Blog Talk Radio.
Where's my theme? What are we doing wrong here? What's going on? Where's my theme? All right, let's do it the old-fashioned way. Hang on. Theme. Morning theme, show opening. Here we go. Let's play it now. Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. I wonder what else is not going to work today. It's Monday morning, setting a new broadcast season, and once again, we have our usual glitches and issues. Usually when that happens, when the show theme doesn't start, I have all these audio clips, and I'm always adding some and then taking away from them, and you know, most times I remember to resort them so that they refresh, but every once in a while, you know, something happens. So, I'll just play it on my own. Okay, so I'm unmuted. That's good. Gene's out there. Gene's going to check in a minute and tell me whether I'm actually broadcasting anything at all. This is one of Gene's most important functions, is let me know I'm on the air.
Yes, you are, Greg. Good morning.
You know, keeping the show going. Oh, yeah. Okay, good. All right. Just want to make sure. When I don't hear the theme, of course, my heart sinks. I'm thinking, okay, what else can go? Where do we go from here? And then that's when my chair starts sinking because I still need a new gas cylinder and I'm broadcasting, you know, at nose level. Here we go again. You know, what do you mean nice one day? I'd like to visit, you know, those radio stations or those really, like, really big stars, you know, with their, remember Rush used to have the gold-plated EIB microphone. He had this whole set up there. I mean, he didn't start that way, of course, you know, but he had a lot of stuff and, you know, of course, the Ditto Cam and all that. And you listen to folks like Dennis Prager and Sean Hannity and Mark Levin. You know, he's got these outrageous studios. Anyway, someday we will too, and I won't have to worry about things like the theme, you know, whether I'm broadcasting or not. I'm going to try and get levels. Everybody that broadcasts has levels. They have these levels of output from your microphone, so you can actually see what's going on. Okay, I still have stories from last week, but I'm not going to do them because. I mean, you know, I've had them for years. So last week you got a really good idea of where we were, what we knew, how much we knew. The information was there, but you had to look for it. You had to actually ask the questions. You know, what kills COVID? What kills viruses? What's really going on here? Where are the early treatments? And if you didn't ask those questions and you didn't get the right answers, you got the government propaganda thing. And there was something fascinating that happened last night. I think it's a repeat because I think I saw it last week. But Mark Levin, he does Life, Liberty, and Levin on Fox News at 10 o'clock at night. I missed the early one because I'm still on the day job. So I cast a later version. And they had Tim Scott and they had Harvey Risch. Now, Harvey Risch is a really intriguing person to me, because he's one of the best epidemiologists in the country. He's certainly, also the best known. He's at Yale. So he's the epidemiologist for the Yale, you know, School of Public Health, Yale Med School. I mean, this is top, top, top epidemiologist in the country. And so, of course, you know, you never hear of him because he's telling the truth. And Dr. Fascist and Burks and Redfield and, who's the new Twinkie at Food and Drug Administration or CDC, whatever her name is, keeps parroting the old government line. And Harvey Risch is really clear. He says, look, the government's in the vaccine business. He just said this. The government's in the vaccine business. They're there to sell vaccines. And everything they do is about selling vaccines. And every story and every bit of information is about selling vaccines. That should have been worldwide news. You know, and like I say, I think he said it last week. But I heard it again this week. I'm going to write him. I've been in touch with Harvey. Harvey's a really cool guy. And because he's not one of the most famous people in the world, he's not, you know, completely swamped. He actually, you know, we get to correspond and get emails back and forth. And I've asked several people to endorse a couple of our bills, particularly the one reforming the emergency use authorization in the FDA that was written by Dr. Zelenko and me. And then the other one, of course, is the full product liability on vaccine manufacturers. And again, something that affects all of us is Section 230, you know, reforming Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gave to providers of interactive computer services, you know, that's big tech, okay, That's what they call it. They call it interactive computer service. If you're on social media or if you're using a search engine, that's called an interactive computer service, you know, according to the law. And so there are two sides of interactive computer services. There are the providers, which is them, you know, Facebook, Google, Twitter, you know, all the social media sites and all the search engines. And then there's us, you know, the users. Okay. So that's all of us who get censored, get blamed, get kicked off, get, you know, told we have false information when it's true. We're the users. And so what this ridiculous section of the law did was it gave power to the providers to regulate what's said by the users. Okay. That's irrational. That's insane. That's just dumb. You can't do that. I like the old phone system. You know, you rent a phone from AT&T, you say whatever you want, but you're still responsible for what you say. So if you advocate, you know, harm to the president or things like that, the Secret Service can still arrest you. The phone company doesn't. They don't have anything to do with it. You know, what you've said. And if someone reports you, then, hey, you know, it's your fault for saying something stupid like that. But that's what should happen with what we call internet, you know, providers now. They have liability from anything you say anyway, because they're not publishers, you know, but they still have, we're given this, you know, this good faith authority to make sure nothing offensive or quote otherwise objectionable, whatever that means, ended up on social media. We know it means anything that the left objects to. That's what they call anything otherwise objectionable. So I wrote a law, very simple. All these providers of internet services have full product liability so long as they don't touch anything that you know, put online. And this is where we're going to channel Rush Limbaugh again. But Greg, what about all that offensive material and otherwise objectionable stuff? Well, it's none of their damn business. It's not the business of the providers to regulate that. Those things are covered by the obscenity laws and the pornography laws, especially the child pornography laws, which makes all this stuff illegal. Okay? So you don't have to give authority in law twice. All right? Once it's given, it's given. If something's illegal, you don't have to make it illegal again. It's not more illegal because you made it illegal in two different places. So you take all that authority away from big tech to touch anything of any content. It's none of their damn business. That's not their job. Their job is to provide you with, you know, search engines and social media, you know, and in return, you watch their advertising and you give them all your information. In return, they target market you. And that's how they make money. And that's okay. That's the business. That's why it's free, even though it's not free. It's only free in the sense that you're freely giving your information. They're freely taking it. That's the only thing that's free about interactive computer services. But they have no right to touch anything that you say. And if it's illegal, it's going to get prosecuted under other laws, which make it already illegal. Very simple stuff. Anyway, so I'm digressing a bit. But those are the kind of things that you know, I like to talk about. And hopefully I'll get to Harvey Risch. I want to ask him about that because I should get a video. What he said last night was absolutely brilliant. And what was nice about it was it's so refreshingly honest and straightforward. And you don't really get that. So if you get a chance, go back and listen to Mark Levin with Harvey Risch. Anyway, so we're going to start our I call today's show Another Year of Wonderful Resistance. And so the resistance begins again. I've written down a bunch of things where resistance is happening. It's really kind of encouraging that Americans are you know, saying, wait a minute. Yeah, we don't have to accept the mandates, the masks. We don't have to accept all this crap. And what about that wonderful guy that said, let's go Brandon to Brandon? I'm still laughing over that. I'm surprised that guy hasn't been thrown into the D.C. gulag with the Trump supporters for, you know, walking into the Capitol. So apparently he has been, you know, he gets the usual death threats, and the guy's been, you know, they know who it is. I mean, obviously, you don't talk to the president without the insurrectionists without the entire Secret Service and all the White House establishment knowing who you are. So let me talk to Brandon. Yeah, wouldn't that be fun? Hey, Gene, you want to talk to Brandon? What would you say? Would you say, let's go, Brandon, or would you be a little more authoritative than that?
Well, to be honest, if I would ever talk to him, I wouldn't say, let's go, Brandon. I don't know how I would address him. If I would say, Mr. President, because of, you know, my feelings, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't speculate because I don't, you know, ever want to be in a situation to meet him. But it was just really interesting to hear that, and that he responded back. It's like, I mean, Trump back, yeah, let's go, you know, let's go, Brandon. It's like, oh my God. And then people are upset because, you know, the guy said that, you know, because they said it, you know, it's a slam on the president, which, I mean, really it is, if you think about
it. Well, it would be
it.
If he was the president, but he's not. That's what I think people are objecting to. Yeah, yeah.
Right, but it's just ironic that why would he even say something? And I was just waiting for Jill to say something, but, you know, she's
Okay, tell me about Jill. Jill fascinates me in her lack of interaction. She was there supervising the blue bottles, the nurses that were doing their whatever it was, that shtick thing that they did, singing, you know, some Christmas carol. Half of them were masked. But what is it about Jill Biden? And I've noticed this, and here's a body language thing. This is, tend to put the life coach hat on. You watch her whenever she's with Joe Biden. She never looks at him, not once. I have never seen a first lady not look at the president when the president's speaking. She looks directly ahead in the camera. It's like she's there, but she's not there. And this is a weird phenomenon. So I don't know if there's a word for this, disassociation or something like that. But you watch Nancy Reagan with Ronnie. She always looked at Ronnie. You look at Rosalind Carter would always look at Jimmy. Melania looks at the Donald. You know, let me see if we can go back through some of the others. The Bushes. I forgot who was
Barbara,
Bush the Younger.
Laura.
It was Barbara Bush for Bush the Elder. She always looked at him.
Yeah.
You know, they had great feelings for their husbands. And then who was Bush the Younger's wife?
Laura.
They have two kids. Laura Bush. Okay. And you know, pretty decent people, all of them. You know, I have nothing against first ladies, you know, except Michelle Obama, simply because I don't believe that, you know, her husband legitimately won either. In fact, I've got the Joe Arpaio. Remember when I played Dr. Walter Williams Friday? I'm going to get you out the Joe Arpaio interview. I'm going to play that one where he says, yeah, there's no, you know, the birth certificate's a fraud. I got it on tape. I, you know, I'm going to play it for you. So I got all this cool stuff. I got the Benghazi stand down order comments from two soldiers who were there. You know, I've got some really amazing stuff. This is been back in the WEBY archives. I forgot Michelle. I'm not trying to slight Michelle, but I just object to the Obamas. You know, they totally screwed up this country. But I believe that, from what I remember, when Barack spoke, she looked at him, right? So what's going
right
on now? So why would Jill Biden stare directly ahead in the camera? I mean, she's sitting beside him, but she doesn't look at him. She doesn't acknowledge him at all. I just find that strange. What does that say to you?
Well, I got my own opinions on a lot of things, but
it may say nothing to you, and that's okay. But go ahead. I want to hear your opinion.
She's got her own agenda. I can't speak if there's any love between them, affection, anything. But the thing is, definitely she has her own agenda just because she pushed him into running for president. And, mm-hmm. I mean, he's not even capable sometimes, I think, of knowing his own name, unfortunately. And, you know, I know for a while we thought, well, maybe he's just putting on a good show. You know.
He's not even doing that.
Yeah, you know, no, because sometimes, when you try to listen to one of his interviews, I mean, mm-hmm. he can't even get a coherent thought out. He can't remember the people the places where he's at. He can't remember who's the mayor, who's the whatever person's name that's involved there. And granted, he's got a lot of people that he deals with on a daily basis, but, you know, when you're going out and you're giving a speech and you kind of praise people, you should know who you're praising, you know? Uh-huh. And so I just think, I don't know. I think he's evil and crooked, and I think she even is lower than that. I mean, anybody that has, like, she gets upset because they don't talk to her as Dr. Jill Biden. You know what? Just because you got I don't even know if she has a PhD. I don't even know. I don't know if it's a PhD or is it just a doctor.
No, I think she has a PhD in education. You know, be interesting.
Yeah, I know it's
thesis.
An education. But I don't I didn't know if it's a PhD or, you know, like in therapy, a lot of people just get the doctor of and not a PhD. Totally different regiments of schooling and classes and stuff, and I don't remember when I did looked up all her information. But even regardless of that, it is like you're a person, and you know, when I meet a doctor, they don't all want to be known as Doctor So and So. It's like, get your ego out of it and just be a human. But no, she's so into image and everything else that I just think it's very sad, very sad.
And well, you wonder what kind of marriage they have. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I haven't seen anything about their Christmas trees at the White House this year.
Oh, I have.
Yeah. I mean, look, they made a big stink of how ugly Melania's were. And I'm like, I didn't think they were ugly. You know,
oh, her decorations
were very
beautiful. Oh, no.
Very classy.
I forgot where I saw this. But the, no, there was a special. There was a I forgot exactly where I saw it, but there was an incredible display of Melania's, you know, beautiful trees and lights and decorations. And then he had Jill Biden's looked like they were wrapped up by junior high kids who had nothing better to do but slap paper on boxes as quickly as possible and tape it badly. I mean, she had all these red boxes. I mean, they look horrible. It looked like, you know, Marxist Christmas, you know, atheist Christmas. We'll have to do this. You know, it's like they were a bunch of kids were ordered to do it. They look terrible. I mean, they really do look terrible. But she looks terrible. I mean, you know, everything about her is screams, you know, elder abuse. Everything about her screams ego. And she's, you know, but she's got no basis for it because, you know, she wants the authority and the power, but she's not getting the respect and the legitimate authority. She's just there. It's weird.
Right. Well, if you look at how she dresses a lot of times, too, and I brought this up in the past, and uh-huh. I mean, I'm not the fashionista, but it's like sometimes she dresses like, it's like, are you kidding me? You are the first lady, and she's to me, it looks like she's trying to compete with a 16-year-old. You're not young anymore. I mean, not that you have to dress, you know, haggardly, but it's like, you know, even they always made a big deal about Michelle Obama and what she wore, and she spent very little money on a lot of her things, her outfits, uh-huh. Not more, yes.
No, other people did. Other people spent money on Michelle's outfits, like $20,000.
Right. Yeah. But
same with Hillary,
The thing is, Jill Biden, I don't even know the last time I saw her looking, like, really classy.
Well, has she made the cover of anything? Usually the First Lady makes the cover of like Vanity Fair or Glamour or I mean Melania was
Super
Bowl. You know, she
has, and I don't remember which cover she's been on, but that was an issue a while back. So,
Car and Driver.
You know, Jill has been on covers of magazines and Melania, they never did. Well, it's interesting that Melania was on magazines before she became president, and then after, not president, but before President Trump became president, and then after he got into the White House, then it's like she couldn't even get designers to design a pair, you know, a dress for her because of who she was married to.
Well, that's because they were prejudiced. Yeah, all those designers.
I mean,
but
how
sad
is that? What
magazine though would you put Jill Biden on? Popular Science, Popular Mechanics. I mean, where would you put Car and Driver? You know, where would you put her? You know, Field and Stream. what magazine would she be on the cover of? Because she's not a glamorous person. You know, if you're going to put her somewhere, we're getting really petty this morning, but I don't care. This is funny.
Well, the thing is, you know, beauty is not, you know, it's not an outside thing to me. It's like, and with her, there's no beauty about her. You listen to her talk, there's no compassion. You know, she can't relate to the regular person. Even when they went to the children's hospital, how they spun things into their own narrative, into their own needs to get their agenda across. You know, it's not always about you. It's about the people involved. Or when, you know, President Biden went to, when the military people came back and he was talking about his son dying. You know, it's not about you all the time. It's like sometimes you have to take a step back and really listen to people, let them talk. You know, you can give your condolences, whatever. But even in that case, it's like, I don't know how you can give your condolences when you're the one that literally killed them by your incompetency.
Interesting. I just looked up really quickly as you're talking here, Joe Biden's doctoral thesis for education. The first thing that comes up, Jill Biden's doctorate is garbage because her dissertation...
Yeah.
What does it say here now? Let's take a look at this. Dissertation explain. All right. oh, this is good.
Yeah.
I like this one. Wait. I just pull out here. This is kind of funny. Jill Biden's garbage. Dissertation explain. It says to call Jill Biden's dissertation's thin gruel is to insult gruel. Whatever meager substance puddled in Bob Cratchit's miserable bowel at mealtime was a bountiful feast compared with this paper. How do you really feel? There were yesterday about the problems with this capstone project, the foundation for her ed degree, and of the insistence of so many in recent days that we must call her doctor. Mrs. Biden's only original research consists of interviews with two. That's right, two ex-students and a few colleagues at Delaware Technical Community College. Oh, there's an institute of fine learning, I'm sure. I mean, you know, nothing against the technical community colleges, but I mean, it's not Yale or Harvard, all right, where she used to teach. Oh, that's where she taught. Plus the results of a vacuous questionnaire she wrote that was returned by about 150 people who worked or studied there. Oh, and she also called two nearby community colleges seeking interviews about their retention rates. What exactly did she write on? Oh, here we go. The dissertation, Student Retention at the Community College. You know, meeting students' needs. Well, there's a doctoral thesis if ever there was one. Sounds like more like a marketing paper, doesn't it? Student retention at the community college. You know, shimmers with the when, term paper feel of middle school. Although in defense of today's middle schoolers, they at least know how to use spell checking software, unlike Mrs. Biden, her 2006 paper notes that at Delaware Tech, her then employer, a third of the students dissolve into the ether every year, and in order to pad out her micron-thin proposals, none of which, you know, have anything to support them except her beliefs and anecdotal evidence. All right, I'm reading this, folks. I haven't even proofed this myself yet. She shovels piles of dribble. Okay, so she doesn't sound like she's really qualified to be a doctor to me. I don't see where the title comes from. We should read the paper. You want to read the paper? I'll dig it up for tomorrow. That sound like fun?
I was reading some before when I was looking up all her information, and I wasn't impressed back then. I know a lot of people that have doctorates. Most of them are not the PhD, because usually PhD programs are very rigorous. Mm-hmm. You know, not as much as medical school, no, but some can be very rigorous. And
Well, there's doctors and doctors. There's doctors of English. There's doctors of mathematics.
Right.
You know, a doctor just means you have a PhD. But a medical doctor is a specific doctor that's different. Those are harder to get because you got four years of undergrad, 4 years I think 3 years of med school. Plus you do internships, residences. You've got your special study. You've got maybe years of study beyond that. You know, unless you're Dr. Fascist, there's another woefully underqualified individual. You know, all he has is a basic med degree. He has no specialty in microbiology, and he's certainly not a virologist. And yet there he is at NIH, you know, infectious diseases and virology. So he should be fired, you know, probably for lying on his resume. I'd love to see his original job application. Oh, yeah, it's virologist, microbiologist. He doesn't have any of those titles. So you look
but
at
you
most
know,
of the people. Go ahead. Yeah.
One time you get a job in government, if you kowtow the line, you have that job for life. Who's going to get rid of you?
A reformed civil service, which actually that's one of our proposals. There's a fairly well-known conservative commentator who has her own show now. I'm not going to mention her just yet, but we talked about doing that, a civil service reform. But like most things, I'll probably end up doing it myself. If folks wonder why I write a lot of the bills, there's a reason, okay? Because I want them done. And I'm perfectly happy to have other people write them. Don't get me wrong. But if you're not going to do it, it's like you know, the vacuum. The vacuum needs to be filled. And so that's as much as I loved and respected Dr. Walter Williams, I couldn't get him to get his PhD candidates to get off their lazy, you know, big butts and actually look at the Constitution and write a constitutional budget. They didn't do it, so I did it. Would have been better if they'd done it because they have resources and they got the whole George Mason University and computers and all that stuff. Basically, I just had my little you know, iMac desktop. You know, but still, if things aren't being done, then we have to do them. And which brings us to back to our we circle back here as Jen Psaki. Wasn't she supposed to quit this year? What's she still doing there?
I thought she was supposed to quit this year. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe by the end of the year, we only have a few more days left. I don't know. Or maybe they talked her into staying a little bit longer. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a weird week, too, because everybody thinks that, you know, we're all on holiday. We're not doing live shows. This is a live show, folks. If you're listening right now, we're live. Okay, if you're listening after the 6 to 9 hours in the morning Central Time, then we're not live. You're listening to a podcast. But if you're here, you can call us now, 215-383-3832. I'm not sure what's going on yet with Dr. Pry. He may or may not be able to join us later. It was a heroic effort last week. I mean, I couldn't believe he actually called.
That
was outstanding. You want to talk dedication? You know, and this is something you don't see a lot of today either, is dedication. There's a man that's dedicated. You know, he spent his lifetime, you know, learning about things that most people find, you know, horrifying, you know, nuclear weapons. He's a physicist. He's a historian. He studied the Constitution, you know, and we have him here on our show. It's a real blessing. And even though he gets technical sometimes and, you know, he answers questions. You know, I'll ask him one question and 20 minutes later, we're still talking about it. You know, I mean, that's just part of the charm, I think, of someone like Dr. Pry. You know, he's at a different level. You know, I mean, I can talk pretty basically about a lot of things. everything with him is a comprehensive lecture, which is quite interesting. But we'll see if he comes on today. If not, we'll just talk, because we certainly have plenty to talk about. And a lot of what this show is inspired by what Gene talked about last week is it's time to talk about our New Year's resolutions. Do you want to save those for tomorrow? Do you have some for today? I got tons of things that the chat about here, but I just want to check in with you on that.
We can save them for tomorrow or later in the week. It's fine. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about resistance then. And I was sort of writing down some notes, and I was thinking about this over the weekend too. There's a huge amount of resistance. Remember that show we did? It's a few months ago now. We said where we've switched from conformity to resistance, where people are – it was that Trump rally. And I got a problem with Trump too. But, yeah, I'll tell you about that in my – well, I'll tell you right now. Trump and Bill O'Reilly are doing this little show tour, kind of I guess they're trying to copy Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla, which apparently was fabulously successful. And you want to talk about two people with nothing in common, Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla, other than the fact that they believe in God and America and a few other things. But as far as backgrounds and lives and things like that, totally, totally different people. So they're really good together. But Trump and O'Reilly, you get two old, arrogant leader types that think they know everything, and their age and arrogance. Not that age is a problem. I mean, I'm no spring chicken, but you've got to sort of move with the times and move with the world as the world is moving. And I see a lot of people, they just reach a certain point and they go, okay, that's it. Time stops here. So time stopped for them, for Bill O'Reilly, probably about 10 years ago, and Trump, I think it stopped for him in 2020 when he let all the government people take over for him. Anyway, so the first resistance thing that I want to talk about in the many levels of resistance that are going on right now is the fact that a bunch of people booed those two, supposedly popular conservative icons when they announced they got the booster shot. Now, I find that fascinating. All right. So nobody believes the crap anymore. The biggest, I think, one of the biggest resistance going on right now is Omicron. Omicron's a joke. It's a cold. You've got masks and vaccine mandates, and they're trying to push this on us. Everybody's laughing at them. Ridicule, one of the four, the four points of resistance to tyranny, parallel structures, ridicule, three things that are most important to getting rid of tyranny, truth, ridicule, and parallel structures. We are a parallel structure. Or a parallel legislature to the ones that aren't working. Ridicule. We do that all the time. That's why I call them Dr. Fascist. Truth. And speaking the truth, as much and as far as wide as possible, people are doing that. They're booing. They booed Trump and Bill O'Reilly when they said they were boosted. Not only just vaccinated, but boosted. And of course, the vaccine definition keeps changing. Fully vaccinated means, whatever they want to sell this week. how can you hold people to a legal standard when the standard keeps changing? That's like saying, grand larceny is $1,000. Well, now it's $10,000, $100,000. So people who are convicted under $1,000, well, it's no longer grand larceny. It's now petty larceny. So how come they're not being freed? So you can't keep changing the standards of justice. Now they're changing the standards of fully vaccinated. Just because they can change the definitions because they're in power, doesn't mean that they should. Remember Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park? He looks at David Attenborough. He looks right at Richard Attenborough. He says, you only asked if you could. You never asked if you should. Okay. That's the whole part of Jurassic Park. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. So they keep changing definitions, changing. They've taken the power, and the geldings have let them have the power, but that doesn't mean they should do what they're doing. Of course, the answer to most of what they're doing is no. But what do you think about them being booed? I find that very encouraging. What do you think, Gene? You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. I think it's, I just think it's good for people to vocalize their feelings. And that's fine. But the bottom line is, anybody, if you want to get the vaccine, get the vaccine. If you don't want to get it, don't get it. But it's our bodies. We should be the ones that have a say whether or not we're going to do it or not. Nobody else can tell us. And so for them, and I know what they're doing is, but it's kind of like the people that go to his rallies, they're probably – not everybody, because I know people that are Trump supporters that are vaccinated. But I think more people align with him that are unvaccinated than people unvaccinated aligning with Biden. But when you go to things like You don't want to, I mean, I wouldn't want to be told, you know, and not that they told people to get the vaccine because I didn't listen to what they said, except for, yeah, I heard that they were booed in. I guess the Candace Owens and Trump interview, too, is causing some, or not causing, gaining.
I haven't heard that yet.
I've not watched it either. No, I haven't. Okay. And I think for this New Year's resolution, I'm going to start taking more of a step back in politics because it's not keeping me in the best positive light. And I just find it interesting that people booed him. And for, you know, Bill O'Reilly, you know, I'm sure he's gotten booed, you know, it with what he says does. You know, people disagree with some of that stuff, his, you know, his philosophy, his opinions. But with Trump, you know, how many times have people actually booed him? You know, and I'm saying not people that follow him. You know, you go to something like where he was at their rally, not a rally, I don't know what their, whatever you call it. But when there are people there, those are the ones that like Trump. So, yeah, to be booed, you'd be like, holy crap, what just happened?
Let me mute here. Yeah, I'm still here. I'm just rearranging things. Well, here's a question for you. And I'm, as you're saying this, you know, Trump's not used to being booed. And, I mean, most people think that Trump supporters march in lockstep and we agree with everything he says. And, of course, you listen to my show. You know that's not true because I've been battling, you know, what Trump's been saying since, you know, February of 2020. So we're coming up on 2 years of disagreement with pretty much everything Trump's done and said. But what's interesting is the perception out there is that Trump supporters are blind followers. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly's a known conservative. So everything he says is gospel. And of course, these guys are becoming the old conservatives. They're becoming not because they're old, but because their thinking is old. Their lockstep is old. They're becoming rhinos in a way. It's kind of weird in that they've sort of gone with the government line. And Bill O'Reilly's been that way for a long time. I lost respect for Bill O'Reilly about 5 years ago. He used to be pretty good. I mean, he was feisty and, he went out there and talked about stuff and he was on the edge. But then he became, you know, like George Will, you know, another person who's totally succumbed to the government line. It's like they found comfort in their institutions and now they're happily living in their institutions and they won't come out. Trump's heading that way really fast. You know, he's taking the Kool-Aid, as they say. He's believing the government line. He thinks ventilators were a wonderful thing, even though they're 97 to 99% fatal for COVID patients. And I've been reading about pulmonary edemas and how the kidneys can, fail and just pour fluid into your chest cavity and how you can suffocate. And the thing to do, of course, is drain the fluid and stop the kidneys from, start the kidneys doing their job again, rather than trying to blast air in, you know, and, you know, they're not solving the problem. They're killing people. And yet he's still proud of his ventilators, you know, and it's like, you don't get it, dude. You just don't get it. It's my biggest thing with Trump. It's my biggest problem with him. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand that, you know, these vaccines aren't vaccines, that they aren't helping, that if you lose more people after the vaccines are initiated than you did before the vaccines were initiated, then maybe vaccines are the problem, okay? And I don't know, there's a disconnect here. It's like the more people they kill, you know, after these messenger RNA GMO bioweapon, quote-unquote, vaccines, you know, came out, the more they want more of them. I mean, it seems to me, if you're doing something that's causing more death than the previous year when you weren't doing it, you'd want to stop doing what you're doing and reevaluate. And yet they're not doing that. They're doubling down. Why? Because it's a marketing campaign. It's all about sales. It's got nothing to do with health. It never did. You know, we've said that, you know, ad nauseum. We've said that so many times. But that's not the issue. The issue is why doesn't Trump know that? Why doesn't Bill O'Reilly know that? Why aren't they saying that? Why aren't they saying to Brandon, hey, Brandon, you killed more people, you know, after you stole the White House, you know, with your vaccines than died beforehand. You know, Trump's got a lot of problems. He's still, and the other thing is that Harvey Risch brought out last night with Mark Levin, early treatment. He said right out that of the 700,000 people that have been lost, he says you could have saved 85% of them with early treatment. Okay. That's a lot of people. That, again, should be worldwide news. That interview last night should be worldwide. I'm going to look for it.
Go ahead. I have to say, though, when you talk about early treatment, I just talked, my sister was telling me over the weekend, in my small hometown, there's another person there that's now on a ventilator. And the sad thing is, well, the thing is, she went to the doctor. They sent her home. They sent her home. Yeah, they said, you know, go home. But that's when they should have started giving her the ivermectin and things like that. And I know they don't believe in it. I mean, I don't know if they don't believe in it. The hospitals
won't
allow it.
Why don't they believe in it?
But it's because of the NIH and CDC and all those that they're pushing, which is really sad. They need to get government out of healthcare. That's all I got to say. Government needs to get out of healthcare. But with that, it's like people go to get early treatment and they're sent away. Why? Come back if it gets worse. So with my friend who just came out of the hospital a couple weeks ago, that's what she was told by her home health agent or home health nurse. And I told you guys this a couple times, and the doctor at the hospital. It's like early treatment is the key, but yet they're not getting early treatment.
Well, isn't early treatment the key to any virus infection or disease?
Right.
You know, if you break a bone, do you say, oh, wait a couple more weeks until it really hurts, then we'll fix it? That you'd be arrested.
Right. But that. Then you could say too, because you've talked about this a lot, what you said last year, you knew this last year and whatever. But the thing is, what I'm getting at is a lot of people still don't know, because once they may not be too politically involved, meaning they listen, but maybe don't listen to a whole lot of things. And so what they listen to is not, you know, how many people, I mean, there are people that are pushing the ivermectin and things like that. They're getting that information out. But the still majority of people that are on the air in various, if you watch TV, if you listen to radio, whatever podcast, there's not a whole lot that are talking about it. Or have talked about it as a positive light. So these people are still believing what's been told to them, which is very sad.
Yeah, I was just I'm just writing something down here real quick. You know, COVID-19 brought to you by government healthcare. All those subject to government healthcare, I mean, the entire COVID-19 pandemic problem, the 2 years of crap that we suffered through, that's because of government healthcare. I mean, Gene, you made that point earlier, but you sort of inspired something that I want to look more into. But anything that, you know, under normal circumstances, normal private health care, like Dr. Zelenko, Dr. Risch, Dr. Some of these other folks, Raoul in France, you know, doctors have left to do what they do normally, which is read studies themselves and look for the best information and cure the patients. The people that are actually treating patients, they're all using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. There are hundreds of thousands of people across this country that have had early treatment are doing just fine. And you can talk to them, interview them, and do all kinds of things because they're still here. The people you can't talk to are the ones that died on ventilators. You know, so if you want to just take a look at the success rates of the early treatment versus the success rates of the, you know, wait until you're so sick you have no choice but to go to the hospital crowd, then we'll give you remdesivir, which makes your kidneys fail, make your lungs fill with fluid, and then we'll try and blast out that fluid with a ventilator rather than draining it and fixing your kidneys. That's killing people. And we know that's killing people. And yet they're still killing people.
Right, and the sad thing is, you don't have a family member there that can be that person's voice. I mean, it's really sad when they get into the hospital, their cell phones are taken away. Why are you taking their cell phone away?
Well, so they don't get help.
That should be crap. Until they lose consciousness, if they happen to, you know, before a family member can get in there, they should have access to communication to the outside.
Well, that's isolation. That's part of tyranny.
That is just awful. Awesome.
Yeah, no, that's how you kill them. You isolate people until they're in such a state that they can't talk anyway. I mean, those phones should be available for family members to call too. What if a family member wants to use that person's phone because they want to call somebody on that person's, you know, phone directory?
Well, the thing is, you know, that person, the family members aren't allowed in the hospital, are they?
Right, and why is that? Isolation.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
If they save them, they wouldn't get the money.
Well, so, exactly, again, death is...
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And I tell you, Greg, I talked to someone over the weekend that she's a nurse. She doesn't even work in the hospital. She works in a clinic. And she gets, when she gets called in or works an extra shift or whatever, she gets paid, you know, her salary overtime because she's working more than she's supposed to, plus another bonus because it's, I don't want to say hazard. I don't remember what they're calling it now.
Combat pay.
Obviously, those people are getting paid. I mean, the organizations have money to pay this exorbitant salary. So let's say her salary, let's say, make it easy, $20 an hour, or maybe $25 an hour. No, I mean, RNs make more. She's an LPN, so she doesn't make quite that much.
Okay.
So let's say she makes $25 an hour. So she mm-hmm. gets time and a half. So that's another, well, let's say that's another about $15.
Okay.
All right. So that's $40. Plus then she gets another, whatever, $15 an hour, this severance
incentive.
Pay or whatever.
Incentive pay.
So,
yeah. Okay.
Incentive pay, whatever. So that's, mm-hmm. what is that? That's about $60-$65 an hour when her normal salary is $20. And, mm-hmm. and it's like, where are they getting that money from? Because, and the reason I'm asking you this, if they can pay her $60 an hour, then why aren't they paying her $60 an hour all the time? You know,
well, because,
like,
they're not stealing the government tax money. I'll tell you where it comes from. It's the Center for Medicare Systems. It's Medicare funding. That's where all this is coming from. That's where the big – it's tax – basically, it's our money. So the government is using our taxpayer money against us to fund death in the hospitals so that they can then push vaccines on people. So they're actually spending our money to force us to spend our money, and they're double dipping. They're getting rich in both areas, rich off death
right,
and rich off their vaccine treatments, which don't work.
Right. Then I got another issue. I talked to someone else, and mm-hmm. I've had to get COVID tests quite a few. Most of
right.
them I get right at work. But I think the very first one I got, yeah, I think it was the very first one I got, I was in Virginia. Ironic, at that nursing home I was at, the National Guard was called in to do COVID testing to everybody. They lost my COVID test. So I had to go to an outpatient clinic to get a COVID test, which I think is just absolutely ridiculous how you can lose it when mine was taken the same time everybody else was, so it should have all been in there. But anyway...
Probably negative,
I had to go
there.
And I've had to go, and because of jobs, I've had to go to clinics to get a COVID test. And they said
right.
that I should not have to pay anything out of pocket. Either mm-hmm. insurance covers it, and if they don't, the federal government does. Okay, mm-hmm. someone I talked to over the weekend, and this is disgusting. He went to a clinic to get a COVID test. They took his temperature, blood pressure. They charged him an extra $100 because they did those things. They did more than the COVID test. So now places are not just doing COVID testing, they're doing other things so they can bill more. I think that is disgusting.
That's interesting.
Because
it's
if
like
you
while
go
you're here,
COVID
and,
test, you know,
they don't
the
tell
thing
them.
Is,
yeah.
so this is just awful, awful.
Right. It's a racket. It's a racket. Well, and this is the thing. This is government health care. So for all those people that, you know, are screaming and yelling against government health care, saying all these horrible things would happen, everybody said, oh, no, it won't happen. There won't be death panels. There won't be government will take care of people. We'll all be equal. We'll all have equal access to treatment. It's a bunch of BS. This is exactly what's happening now. This is government health care at its finest. Rationed, you know, mandated. this is no competition government health care. So what you're seeing now is exactly what we all told you would happen. The question is, we just have to change it and get it to a completely, you know, a voucher-based health system where people buy their own insurance, where they know what the bills are. I guarantee you, Gene, that when these folks are going to for their blood pressure and temperature checks, those hospitals are not telling them that they're adding $100 to the bill. And they may not even see the bill. It might go directly to the insurance company, but the insurance company then has to pass it on somewhere.
They pass it on to the person, and that's how my friend found out, because he got the bill that he owes now $100. That's a travesty. I mean... That's insane. But also, Greg, you talk about regulations and stuff like that. Non-vaccinated mm-hmm. people are getting turned away from the hospitals. And why? Because, like I said, we don't have room in the hospital.
Oh, really? Really?
Because
are people lined
so
up
many
outside
COVID
the door?
Patients. Well, how many COVID
okay,
patients
so...
have the vaccine? Majority of them.
Yeah. That's just, these are the same hospitals that will take illegal aliens over Americans, people that have no right to be here, that are breaking our laws to be here, that are spending our tax dollars illegally to be here, that the government is forcing, you know, they're basically extorting on human trafficking, all right? So all this stuff is going on, and yet they're saying American citizens can't go to a hospital unless they've taken a chemical jab. You want to talk about a two-tiered society? I mean, this is segregation. This is, I mean, you know, this is like segregating the Jews out in Nazi Germany. They were segregated by religion. Now they're segregating people by whether you've taken a chemical, you know, foreign substance into your body that you don't want. is a desegregation.
Where are all the people that are from My Body, My Choice? Okay, where are they now?
They're getting vaccinated and having abortions. That's what they're doing. You know, that's where they are.
It's your body, your choice, if it's something you agree with. If it's something you don't agree with, well, then it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, these folks behave like hypocrisy is a virtue, you know, because they're in power, so they don't care. So hypocrisy, you can't accuse these people of hypocrisy because they simply do not care. They're able to exercise power. So there's two ways that the power is exercised. One, a group does it illegally, and two, another group lets them. And we've got that now. We've got the perfect storm of Marxists exercising power illegally and geldings letting them.
Right.
Yeah. So the only way to fight that is to get rid of both of them. You got to get rid of the Marxists, and you have to get rid of the geldings. Otherwise, we're not going to find a way out of this. I got a couple more things for you, too. I find the Joe Manchin phenomena fascinating. I want to run a theory by you on that. But just on our independent theme here of resistance, Boston, the mayor of Boston was speaking about something, and she's a new mayor. She's nowhere near as well-liked as the old mayor. The old mayor didn't have vaccine passports, didn't have discrimination. In fact, it's interesting. South Africa had passports, too, based on race. All right. So the white people could go certain places and the black people couldn't. All right. So what's the difference between that and the vaccinated can go certain places, but the unvaccinated can't, you know? So it's not a racial thing where you can actually see, you can't look at a person and see if they've been vaccinated or not. All right. So that's why they have these old passports, but they had passports back in apartheid too. So the Democrats seem to be adopting all the things that they allegedly hate. And I want to talk about Desmond Tutu in a bit. But what about this Boston rally? And the mayor's trying to you know, impose another Marxist mandate, and a bunch of people in the background are singing the Star Spangled Banner. Again, resistance. It's really everywhere. This is a fascinating time we're living in. And this is why I want to try and document all these things now for posterity. When people look back and go, what the hell happened that, you know, after 2016? You people went nuts. Yeah, we did, because someone actually challenged the system. But they would do that. Let's see if I got another one here. I think that's it. It's probably a good time to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece. So let me play that now. When we come back, I've got some things about Joe Manchin, because what's happening in Congress right now is quite fascinating. And again, you want to talk about upsetting the system? They don't know what to do with Joe Manchin. The Republicans don't know what to do with him. The Democrats don't know what to do with him. I don't even think he knows what he wants to do with himself right now. But let me play one more time our founding piece on, just if I find it right here, on the church and state, because church and state is such a dominating factor, especially at this particular time of Christmas, which actually is a religious holiday for those of you who have forgotten. And holiday means holy day. That's a contraction of it. As we used to talk about holy days. So Christmas is a holy day. In other words, a holiday. So I'll be back in a little bit, and we can talk about Manchin and a bunch of – I've got so many articles today. We can easily like I say, if Dr. Price here, great. If not, I have plenty to do, and we'll be back in a little bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. There is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. Therefore, the Supreme Court can't imagine that it really is there, or should be there, so they can't create the rule out of thin air and then enforce it as if it actually did exist. The biggest problem with the controversy between Thomas Jefferson, then president, and the Danbury, Connecticut Baptists, a religious minority, is that everyone focuses on the answer by Thomas Jefferson, saying there is a wall of separation between church and state, but they never consider the request made by the Danbury Baptists that Jefferson sought to answer, and therefore where the wall of separation actually is. If you only have the answer, then you can make the question anything you want, including making the question fit the answer to advance an agenda or denying that there even is a question. The question now is whether the government is free from any of the moral constraints or persuasiveness of religion, such that religion and government are walled off in isolation from each other, so that government can contemplate and implement any power for themselves without any organized religious participation, debate, opinion, objection, or protest. That is a complete bastardization of the exchange between Jefferson and the Baptists, and it has been used to advance a bogus set of laws and court opinions. The background for this controversy comes from the article mentioned below, which says, "The First Amendment was meant as a limit on the National Congress only. Madison wanted limits on the states too, but they were rejected. State limitations on religious liberty and establishment persisted after the First Amendment was adopted. Religious tests for office remained in place in most states, and Connecticut, 1818, and Massachusetts, in 1833, did not disestablish their official state churches until decades later. The Supreme Court reinforced the idea that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states, but rather only to the national government in Barron v. Baltimore in 1833. Back to me. Where this becomes especially critical is when the states, not the state, as in government in general, but the individual states, established their own religion and churches because they were not subject yet to the First Amendment. It is in that context that Jefferson is responding to the Danbury Baptists. The key part of the Danbury Baptist letter to Jefferson is this clause. What religious privileges we enjoy as a minor part of the state, we enjoy as favors granted and not as inalienable rights. And these favors we receive at the expense of such degrading acknowledgments as are inconsistent with the rights of free men. The Danbury Baptists, being a religious minority in a larger group of Congregationalists, which was the state religion of Connecticut, were being discriminated against for not being part of the state religion. And because the First Amendment only referred to Congress making no law regarding the establishment of a government religion, but left the states free to do so, we had religious freedom at the federal level, but privilege and discrimination at the state level. That is why the Danbury Baptists wrote Jefferson. Now Jefferson's response makes sense. He says to the Baptists, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Put in modern English, the individual relationship between man and God is direct, and the wall of separation is so that the government never crosses that wall between individuals, their churches, and God, with state religions, state churches, religious laws and tests, religious qualifications for office, etc., etc. However, there is nothing in law or the Constitution preventing churches, religions, and religious individuals like pastors, priests, ministers, etc., and just regular folks too, from exercising moral persuasion, evaluation, and criticism over government, because the free exercise of religion also includes the redress of government for grievances. The wall of separation of which Jefferson spoke only works one way. To understand Jefferson and the Baptists, it's not the wall of separation between church and state, it's the wall of separation between the free exercise of religion and any state-established religion. That's it. Everything else is agenda-driven narrative. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This episode also used Thomas Jefferson's misunderstood letter to the Danbury Baptists from the Washington, Jefferson, and Madison Institute website. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. dangerously cool. Yeah, we're back here. I just wanted to announce there's a news press conference going out this going out this week on our 25 bills for 2022. And so there's not a whole lot new here because these bills have been around for a bit. There's a few new ones, like the two I wrote for Florida for the last special legislative session. But for the most part, these are just our same principles of freedom that would have made a dynamite, you know, I guess midterm election 2018 would have really helped 2020. Now we're going for 2022. So there's always new bills, but a lot of the same principles, a lot of the same things of the major tax cuts, the court reforms, the jury reforms, you know, the budget cuts, the transparency measures. I don't really like that word, but you know, the open government, you know, things that that we've been talking about for a while. We're going to try and get out in a big press release to all kinds of folks. So if you're any kind of journalist organization anywhere in the world, quite frankly, you want to get on our list, you know, email me at greg@writeyourlaws.com. That's greg at writeyourlaws, WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com, and let you know what's going on. But we've got 25 bills that I'm hoping to encourage some of the people running for Congress to pick up and some of the journalist organizations, you know, to write about. That would be nice. And some of the major folks like Dr. Harvey Risch and others we talk about to endorse some of these bills. So that's the plan right now. That's the plan for this year. And, of course, at CPAC, if we can if I can broadcast from there, that's going to be a big part of it, is talking about our bills with all the fabulous conservatives as they stroll on by my microphone. It's like, hey, Nigel Farage, England, come on, sit down. Let's have a chat. I want to tell you how you and I can change England. Oh, okay. And that sounds like Marvel's idea. Yes, I think I'll sit down and talk to you. Okay, fine. So I'll bring back Gene, my rather snooty British accent here. We shall continue the show without a cup of tea and see what we can do. It's marvelous time, I think. Yeah, it's marvelous. So anyway, aristocrat Brit.
Yeah.
Gene made a comment. Gene made a comment last week. She likes my accent. So you can always call for one. You know, if I don't do one, I'll try my best. But there's some that are you know, I haven't quite figured out yet, but I'll work on it. You know, not good at Spanish accents, not good at African accents, not good at Asians, kind of generic right now. But European ones, I think I got those pretty much down. Maybe it's my white guy heritage that allows me to do that. Of course, I do Indian accents too, and that's, you know, it's a whole different story. All right, so 25 bills to rock 2022, and they will. That's the thing. All right, I want to bring Gene to this conversation because something, again, I always try and look for trends. I look for things that aren't being reported as much, but there's something really fascinating going on. I wonder if I can call Joe Manchin too. Let me put that down here. I tried calling Marjorie Taylor Greene, had no luck. No luck at all. No phone numbers, no. She just want to hear from people that aren't in the district, and you got to fill out a form, wait for a minion to get back to you. We'll see what Manchin, you know, and he fascinates me. So you got a Democrat in a Republican district, in a Republican state, a highly Trump-oriented place, and yet he's popular enough as a Democrat to keep his office. That alone makes him interesting. But the fact that he alone stood, I mean, the Republicans voted against it, you know, against the $5 trillion, you know, socialist wish list of spending. But he's a Democrat, and he was ordered to vote for it. You know, that's from party politics. They order their members to vote. That's why you see these lopsided votes. All the Republicans vote one way, all the Democrats vote the other way. Well, that just tells me they're mindless. They're robots. They're not thinking for themselves. Here's a guy that thought for himself. This is why I thought he'd be a very intriguing presidential candidate. Right. Of course, I mentioned that not one person picked up on it. One person said no. You know, my Facebook page. But Gene, if someone is independent enough to stand up the Democrat Party, you know, and do what's good for the country. I'm not talking about those that stand up against the Republican Party and do what's bad for the country, like the John McCains and the Mitt Romneys. You know, independence, you know, for its own sake is not a good thing. Independence with virtue is. And I believe that Manchin has both independence and virtue. He's standing up for what he believes is right for the country, and he's absolutely right. That spending $5 trillion at this particular time, you know, with inflation bad and everything else bad, is ludicrous, is insane, and borders on my favorite word, irrational. Only a crazy person would even think of spending $5 trillion in this economy. But he's doing it. He stood up against it. He basically killed the bill himself. I think that took guts.
Gene? Well, it is interesting because I was listening to something briefly yesterday on Facebook, and then I couldn't even listen to it anymore because then I just commented, which is sad. I should have listened to the whole thing. But
yeah,
it was about this lady going off on him and what a disservice he is doing for West Virginia. And I just put in that, I don't even know what I commented, but I just said thank you. I said thank you to him and for him doing the right thing because you get all these people that are so upset because, oh, he's not for all this stuff. And but it's like, okay, if you want, well, one thing, a daycare bill or a child whatever bill, I so disagree with that for the fact that if you want to have a child, you should have the means to support that child. The government should not have to subsidize daycare or whatever. Granted, I know they say daycare now is harder to find. So, you know, then there may need to be other things going on to help, you know, so that there is more daycare out there. But it's like, and all this other spending stuff, they say, well, you're taking away money from Medicare, Medicaid. Well, then make a bill for Medicare, Medicaid. We don't need all this other pork.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I listened
no,
to
absolutely.
This morning.
It's the wrong solution. You know, the solution to daycare is not to give more money to daycare, but to tax people less so they don't have to spend money on daycare so that one person can stay home. I don't care
right.
who that
and,
one person is, but, you know, ideally, you know, if you want to have a, the whole, one of the big points about a two-parent family is that the kid is a parent rather than a daycare person or a teacher. You know, kids just spend most of their time, especially really young kids, with a parent. You know, so they're not looking at the big picture. If they're trying to give more money to something that's still undesirable, you're going to have a better funded thing that's undesirable. I don't see the point in that.
Yeah.
I
heard something else today. They were talking about him and what he did. And he said, or that whoever, I forget who was talking about, they said that it's actually, he actually probably did a more positive thing for the Democrats that are up for re-election next year because some of them that would have voted yes to this bill, their constituents mm-hmm. were against, and that may have gotten them voted out of the office. And this way, since they're not voting on it, or not as of now, not yet, they don't have to vote yes because, you know, they tout party lines. They don't have to vote yes, and that way their constituents are happy because they didn't vote yes. They didn't
well,
vote
except
anything,
that any good campaign, any good opposition candidate will say, well, they would have voted yes. The only reason they didn't vote yes is Joe Manchin saved their butts, but they would have voted yes. So you need to know that if the opportunity comes up again, they're going to do what the party tells them. And so there's a way around that. That's how you get around that. The person you're talking about, though, that went after Joe Manchin is Bette Midler. Bette Midler, who I used to love. I mean, she's funny. She was great. You know, she did that film, you know, For the Boys about I think it was the Andrews sisters who sang for the troops, you know, all across World War II. So she's done some good stuff. She did a great duet. It's just kind of funny. Slow Boat to China with Barry Manilow. Fabulous recording. They say, you know, I used to play it on my tour. I go through Chinatown playing Slow Boat to China. You know, I had no PC problems, right? And but it was funny. And that's allegedly a racist song, you know, but I don't care about that stuff. Anyway, so Bette Midler apologizes for Twitter, you know, outburst calling West Virginia poor, illiterate, and, you know, strung out.
She has a lot of knee-jerk reaction tweets because look how many she did for Trump, too. And the bottom line is this. Okay, if you're against something, if you don't like something, fine. Say a tweet. Do whatever. Go on a rant. But then it's like, after the fact, you should not have to apologize because you know, someone said something, and now you're kind of backtracking to say, I don't want to say, don't know if it's save your fan base or what it is, but the bottom line, if you tweet something, if you say something, if you really believe that, you shouldn't have to apologize. I don't care for what it is, but she seems to do that a lot. You know, she says, I don't want to say stupid stuff, but it is
well, the PR people.
Stuff. You know, she'd be better off just not even saying anything at all because people know where she stands. And, you know, to come back and say you didn't mean it, that is hard to believe because, and I don't want to say that because I don't trust that. And I really try to take people at face value. And if they apologize, I take it as an apology. However, in her case, I don't think she's too sincere. I think she's just doing it because yeah, it's her fans. She wants to keep, you know, she wants to keep her livelihood.
Yeah, I think it's the PR people, too. I've got another. Here's the quote. She says, what Joe Manchin, who represents a population smaller than Brooklyn, has done to the rest of America, who wants to move forward, not backward, like his state, is horrible. He sold us out. He wants us to be just like his state, West Virginia, poor, illiterate, and strung out. Well, that's not very nice.
No, and I tell you, I lived in West Virginia, and I love West Virginia. They get a bad rap, and it's really sad. It is very sad. And for someone or her, you know, coming from New York, high mighty, who are you to say about anything unless you've lived there, experienced the life? You coming in there, even if you drive through or you go there to do a movie with your elite class, how they treat you, you don't have a clue what the regular people, common folk, live anywhere.
But this is actually a really good representation of a democracy versus a republic. And so when you look at it, what she's talking about, you know, the Joe Manchin represents a population smaller than Brooklyn. Well, he's a senator, first of all. Well, so population has nothing to do with it. Either things are right or they're wrong. You know, if more people make something wrong, you know, a vote. So in other words, if this is the whole point of the Electoral College. The Electoral College exists so that people in West Virginia have a voice in the presidential election. And it's not all done by people in Brooklyn. I mean, that's the whole point of spreading the election across the country. That's why there are 50 state campaigns, because we don't want Los Angeles, Brooklyn, Manhattan, you know, and a couple of other places, Denver, Miami, deciding the election. So population, the country is to take population out of power and put principles and I hate to say the rule of law, I won't say that, principles and laws and freedom and rights into our government. So, but she wants majority rule. So she thinks if she has people that want your money, in other words, if the people in Brooklyn spend the people in West Virginia's money, that's okay, because that's moving forward because they're the majority. That's what she's saying.
The thing is that she's slamming them because they don't have a whole lot of population. And the thing
why is she slamming them? Because they don't have a lot of population. Because she thinks that we're a democracy. Right?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. But it's like there's a reason why it doesn't have much of a population, and that's not a bad thing. It can be a very good thing. People go to places like that because it's not overcrowded with others. And, you know, it's a quaint life. It's not hustle and bustle.
Yeah, but there are a lot of coal mines that keep the lights on in New York.
You know, Brooklyn, used to. I don't think they have them anymore, thanks to Biden and all.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, it's West Virginia truck drivers that supply the food to Brooklyn. It's West Virginia coal miners that keep the lights on in Brooklyn. It's West Virginia, you know, people paying taxes that keep the basically, you know, the extra government aid coming to Brooklyn. Brooklyn could not exist without West Virginia. The cities can't exist without the country folks. They don't seem to realize that. They think these things can exist on their own. So this is why this is such a great quote, because it's so rich with hypocrisy and meaning. Because you look at it, you know, has done to the rest of America. What did Joe Manchin actually do to the rest of America other than to save $5 trillion? So what she's equating is money is good. So in her world, money is a virtue. The spending of money is a virtuous act by itself, regardless of the consequences. And whose money are they spending? Well, all of ours. You know, it's a redistribution of income, $5 trillion to a bunch of basically rich liberal white people is where most of the money is going. They'll never admit it, but that's where it's going. Yeah.
Right. Why don't they pay, let's just say coal miners or truckers, why don't they pay coal miners, truckers, and those type of workers what they pay movie stars, singers, whatever, performers, and pay performers what they pay coal miners and truck drivers? Then we get a whole different take. You know, it's like,
But that's not what money's based on. Money's based on how much money you're paid, based on how much money you generate. Truckers and coal miners simply don't generate as much money as movie star entertainers. And it's only the top 1% of the movie star entertainers. You got 98-99% of the actors making less than the coal miners and the truckers who are actors. Actors, you know, this is why you see them all waiting tables and things like that, who are trying to break it and make it big. There's a very small population of actors that make it. Whereas, you know, almost all the truck drivers and almost all the coal miners and almost all the plumbers, electricians and forestry managed people and farmers and everybody else is in West Virginia probably makes a fairly decent living. You know, if you're an independent person, you got a family farm, you know, you own your own truck, you know, you're doing pretty well. You're not going to make as much as a movie star, but there's only about, 20 movie stars making all the money? You know, the rest of them are making nothing, you know, so it's a very skewed, it's not a good sample. But here's another line here. He sold us out. So in other words, he's a Democrat who didn't vote the Marxist line, which means he's a bad person. He sold out, the ripoff of $5 trillion. He's not one of us anymore. That's what she's saying. He's not one of us. He doesn't qualify. He has lost his virtue. He has lost his standing. He didn't follow in line like he was supposed to do. He didn't do. He made the crime of thinking for himself. That's what she's saying here. So this is why I find this such a fascinating quote, because there's a lot to this. So that's the real problem.
The weird thing is that Joe Manchin has been an independent thinker for a long time. It wasn't just this.
He's a very intriguing person. He's sort of been on periphery of my radar screen, but I need to bring him right up front. Well, let's try and call his office today and see what kind of luck we have. But he says he wants us all to be just like his state. Well, from what you're saying about West Virginia, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. You know, nice rural fresh air, you know, hardworking, industrious, God-fearing American patriots. I'm sorry, compared to Brooklyn, that's not a bad deal. I think maybe the country should be more like West Virginia based on just on my observation. Now, I want to go to Brooklyn. Don't get me wrong. I think it'd be fun. In fact, I tried to get a report from, we tried to get a Brooklyn Deli report at one person because I have a friend that lives in Brooklyn. You know, these are the contrasts I want to have. I'd love to get a West Virginia coal miner, you know, doing like weather reports and coal and mining forecasts. And then we'll get someone walking around Brooklyn talking about delis, Italian delis, Jewish delis, you know, Asian fast food. I mean, all that stuff. So America's a rich country. You got to appreciate the place you are. Brooklyn has its virtues. West Virginia has its virtues. But they're not exclusive. They're not, you know, it's not that Brooklyn's good and West Virginia's bad. And this is this is the attitude problem that she has. So if you want to live in Brooklyn, if you want to live in a crowded city, great. There it is. You know, if you want to be on the countryside, great. If you want to live on the road and not live anywhere in particular, great. All these things are available as Americans. But there's this sort of this value judgment that somehow Joe Manchin's a bad person because he sold out the Marxist, you know, takeover and destruction of our economy. You know, and then he all wants to be just like his state. Now here's what she thinks of West Virginians: poor, illiterate, and strung out. In other words, drug addicted.
Right.
Well, I get news for you. There's people in Brooklyn. There's a lot of drugs in Brooklyn. Okay, so you want to compare Brooklyn? You want to compare Brooklyn to West Virginia? You know, who's got the healthier lifestyle? I would say West Virginia, unless you're in the coal mine. That has other problems, but I think they've taken care of most of those. Illiterate?
Yeah, I don't even know how many coal mines are still operating. I don't think
lots. Well, there are
a lot. Really? I thought a lot of them are closed down.
Oh, no. You got to keep – coal is one of our biggest resources. You got to keep the lights going. You know, coal-fired power plants are huge, but the thing is, it's clean coal. It's different. The technology is different. So when they burn coal, there are things called scrubbers that take the sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, monoxide, and they take the different chemicals out of the coal. That you're seeing is why – this is why you don't hear about acid rain anymore. Remember acid rain?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was acid rain?
We used to hear
rain,
a lot of it. About it.
Acid rain was hydrochloric, nitric, sulfuric acids. All right, why? Because the coal, when it was burned, was releasing sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, and various other chemicals. Well, those are the big ones, sulfur and nitrogen. And what were they forming? Well, they're combining with oxygen, you know, H2 and hydrogen, H2SO4, N2SO4. You know, these are acids. Okay, so you have sulfuric acid, basically rainwater combining with sulfur dioxide, you know, coming out of the stack of coal of electric power plants. Okay, that's what acid rain was. It was carried for thousands and thousands of miles on, you know, on these droplets, you know, in the upper atmosphere, and eventually they'd get heavy and they'd rain down somewhere, and it was changing the forest. It was a problem. So what did they do? They cleaned up the coal. So we don't hear about acid rain anymore. So environmental problems are very real, but so are the solutions. So why don't we congratulate the coal companies for, and the government for having a nice little, regulatory scheme, not scheme, regulatory program that cleaned up the coal, kept the lights on, you know, kept being able to mine coal, kept being able to burn coal, and cured the acid rain problem. That's a good thing. They won. Strung out. I like that too. All right. Anyway, enough about Bette Midler.
Just sad. Shows how ignorant some people are.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, here's my third. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. But here's my theory on Joe Manchin. Now, Joe Manchin, there's something very strange going on in the Senate. And, of course, we're the only ones talking about this. But what's going on in the Senate right now is you've got 48 Democrats, two independents, and 50 Republicans. So right there, the Republicans should be the majority party, but they're not. So how is it that 48 Democrats, you know, are running the Senate. I was just watching Tim Scott last night on Mark Levin. The Democrats don't include us. They don't tell us what's going on. They're doing all the bills in secret. They're coordinating with the White House, yada, yada, yada. Well, Tim Scott, why don't you do something about it? Why don't you demand, you know, co-chairs? You know, they say that the Senate rules are that the independents, if they caucus with the Democrats, they're counted as Democrats. Well, the first thing the Republicans should have done when they had the majority of the Senate was get rid of that rule. If you're independent, you're independent. If you're a Democrat, you're a Democrat. But you can't caucus with an – you can't be an independent. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't call yourself an independent if you're working with the Democrats. Therefore, you're a Democrat. So you either have to become a Democrat or you can't caucus with the Democrats and you're counted as independent. So independents would not be a party. So therefore, you'd have 48 Democrats and 50 Republicans. Republicans would be in charge of the Senate. If they had any balls, that's what they would have claimed, you know, at the beginning of the Biden insurrection. But they don't have any balls. They're a bunch of geldings. They refuse to claim what's rightfully theirs, which is the Senate majority, because they have 50 Republicans and 48 Democrats. So what they should have done with their 50 Republicans is advocated a rule change and not let the independents vote, because they're independents. It would be a conflict of interest for them to vote on that. And the Senate would have been Republican. But they don't do that because they're geldings. Here's the other thing, too. Even if the Democrats had the – even if you count those two independents as Democrats, it's now 50-50. That still should guarantee co-chairs, one Democrat and one Republican. All the committees should be split. I don't even think they have committees right now. And that way each co-chair would have full access to the same information. That way the Republicans would know everything Democrats are doing. Democrats would know what the Republicans are doing. You'd actually have somewhat of an open government. But then they say, well, wait a minute. You know, Kamala Harris as vice president can break a tie. Therefore, the Democrats have the majority. That's not true either, because she's not part of the Senate. So if you're counting the Senate for regular business, you've got 48 Democrats, two independents, and 50 Republicans. So in the course of, yes, they have an equal number. If you count, even if you count the two Democrats, the independents as Democrats, it's still 50-50. Okay. So that's still co-chairs. So the vice president isn't part of the Senate. The vice president comes in for the sake of breaking a tie. So in the Senate, so when you're not breaking a tie, the vice president has no business in the Senate. So it should still be equal, at least co-chairs. And yet the Republicans have failed to make any of those claims that I just made. Not one. They're happier being losers when they have the majority than they are acting as winners. And you have faith in the Republican Party, and everybody wonders why I unregistered from the geldings? That's why. They've got the majority in the Senate right now. They've had the majority since before Brandon took office, because Brandon's not legitimately there. And yet they're the ones, McConnell and Pence, gave the White House to Brandon. Another problem. And you people want to vote for these folks in 2022? Why? They've already sold you out. They've sold you out to the Marxist Democrats. Now we have someone like Joe Manchin. So here's my interesting claim, though. If Joe Manchin, the Republicans think that, well, if he's not going to be a Democrat, he should be a Republican. And he's not biting. He's not running to the Republican Party. He's certainly not, you know, valued by the Democrats. They think that he sold them out. So what if he became the first truly independent senator? Here's where I think it gets interesting. What if he actually became an independent senator? He's not caucusing with the Democrats because they don't want him. He's not joining the Republicans because he doesn't want to. He wants to be a truly independent senator. He could do anything he wanted. He can say anything he wanted. He could vote any way he wanted. Neither party would have a hold on him. He'd be the first truly independent senator, and he might start a trend for other senators to become independent also. And hopefully that would start to destroy the two-party system. That's why I think Joe Manchin that would be a historic thing for him to do. What do you think? Gene's thinking. So, huh, Greg, that's a lot to throw at this particular point. I do this to her all day long. Gene knows. Gene understands that most of my questions are impossible. They require tons of thought. And then I just say, back to you, Gene. And she's like, oh, yeah. Damn. So I want people to understand that that's what I put you through.
I give him a lot of credit for standing up for what he believes in. And I think he should continue to do so. You know, it's like, I wish more Democrats would, for the fact that it seems like where the Republicans, you know, they tend to, I can't even say they tend to verbalize what they believe in, because I think in the Republican side, you have a unique situation where you got those people that can't stand Trump and those people that are not Rhino Republicans, and then you got the Rhino Republicans. So it's a huge division in the Republican Party. But it's interesting in the Democratic Party where they all toe the line. It's like, what does Pelosi, what does Schumer have on these people that they've got a noose around their neck? And when those two say jump, people don't ask, the Democrats don't ask how high, they just jump. You know, it's like, so, and that is sad.
I mean,
so
I can answer that. I can answer that for you. Committee chairs and campaign funds are the two simplest ones. They don't get money from the party unless they follow the party line. See, the Democrats run their party like a Marxist organization. Well, actually, they are a Marxist organization. You know, you will do what you're told. if you sell your soul to the Democrats to get elected, you will do as you're told. You know, that's how they were able to impeach Trump on a voice vote. It was like a poll. So they basically took a poll in one of the most sacred and difficult and procedural, you know, events, and one of the most consequential events in American politics is to do an impeachment. And yet Pelosi just said, oh, I think he's guilty. Do you think so too? Oh yeah, we do too. Okay, fine. That's like a trial by lynch mob. Y'all think he's guilty? Yeah. Okay, get the rope. What's the difference? They basically did, as Clarence Thomas said, a high-tech lynching of Trump. Who's in favor of him being guilty? I am. Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks for the impeachment. All right, you're guilty. That's not America. That's Marxism.
Exactly.
The lynch mob. Yeah.
For the Democrats to not be held accountable, I just think that's sad, where they can lie through their teeth. He should be in jail. I mean, there's so many of those people.
Who's
going to
hold him accountable?
Yeah, but they.
Trump didn't.
Why are some people allowed? I mean, you even look at Comey. Comey should be charged with something. What he did was wrong. And I don't even say wrong. It's got to have been illegal on some level. But they get by with it. Look at Hillary, all the stuff that's happened, you know, the crookedness that they have done. How come some people are so above the law and other people,
Because good people won't enforce the law. Why is Bill Clinton, after massacring an entire community in Waco, Texas, why is he still walking free? The man's a mass murderer. You know? Why is Dr. Fascist free?
Yeah.
You know, Harvey Risch just said again last night on Mark Levin that 85% of the people that Dr. Fascist has killed by denying early treatment could have been saved. Let's do a quick calculation. I need my calculator here. So hang on. There we go. So 85% of – he said 700,000. I think it's close to 800,000, but I'll trust Harvey Risch. He's the epidemiologist. So 700,000 times 0.85 equals – 595,000, so basically 600,000. So of the 700,000 people that died of COVID, 600,000 died for nothing. And that man's not in jail? That's how many people died in the Civil War.
That just saddens me, because I just know the people I know that have died of COVID, and, you know, I often wonder if they didn't die in vain because treatment failed or whatever.
I hesitate to bring that up, you know. But if you want to talk about it, I don't like to do that on a personal level, because people who know people have died is a tragedy.
Yeah.
But if we can sort of separate ourselves from that, how many of those folks were told there is no early treatment, when of course there is? We're told that you need to take remdesivir, which, you know, killed 50% of the people, you know, gave kidney failure to 50% of the people in the drug trials. That's why they had to stop the trials. Yet because it's under an emergency, it's okay, right? You know, and how many people were then put on ventilators after their lungs filled with fluid because the kidneys failed? So rather than fix the kidneys, rather than stop the drug that caused the kidneys to fail, rather than take the fluid out of the lungs, they just blasted air in, hopefully to push the fluid back out. So you got fluid coming in one way, you got air coming in another way. Well, what do you think happens? The lungs explode or die or whatever happens, drown. And like I said, and I can speak about this from personal experience, not because I had remdesivir and I was on a ventilator. I was on a ventilator during heart surgery because my lungs were filling up with fluid because something went horribly wrong. I think it was the blood thinners. That's the only drug I'd never had before. So what do? Well, we stopped the blood thinners, drained my chest of 4.5 liters of fluid, and let me recover. And I was fine. So this is why I know the blood thinners did it, because as soon as I stopped taking blood thinners, my chest stopped filling with fluid. Well, what does that tell you? I mean, you don't have to be I don't need 4 years of medical school to tell me that when you stop a drug and the problem that almost killed you stops also, that there's probably a connection. You know, it's like vaccines. It doesn't take a master doctor 20 years of schooling to know that if more people are dying after vaccines have been introduced than died before vaccines have been introduced, when the pandemic was far more severe, that the vaccines are probably the problem, because there's your variable. You know, this is not hard to imagine. So when people say, I didn't know, I'm like, well, how could you not know? How could you not have at least a little bit of curiosity to ask a question, which gets to the point of how much of our society is so beaten down through school, through this education indoctrination process, that the ability to question anything is taken out of them.
Right.
Gene, that's where I think our real problem is. You want to talk about root causes? You know, what's the root cause of immigration? Too many people. Okay, well, that was easy to solve. It's not South American countries and bad economies. There's too many people coming to our country. That's the root cause, all right? What is the root cause of everybody kowtowing to the government and following the line? The inability to question anymore that has been removed from people. Now, here's the thing. Kids are curious about everything. Ever talk to a five-year-old?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Aren't they great? I love five-year-olds. Why? Because they haven't learned not to ask questions yet. They haven't learned to be polite. They haven't learned to kowtow. They haven't learned that, you know, it's above their pay grade. They haven't learned that there are experts who will tell them the truth. They just want to know, okay? So if you want to solve this problem, talk to a five-year-old and then adopt their attitude. I'm serious. I'm perfectly serious in this. If you want to know how to fix this country, start talking to five-year-olds. Not that they know the answers, no, but they know how to ask the questions. So if you can learn to ask questions like a five-year-old, all this becomes very simple. This is why I pose very simple questions. If I could speak to Dr. Fascist, my questions would be very simple. Why did you kill more people than the Civil War? Huh? Well, look, you've had over 700,000 people have died, and we know that most of them, 85% of them died for no reason because you refused early treatments. So why did you kill more people than the Civil War? It's a basic question. It's very simple. You know, I'd ask Brandon, what are you doing in the White House? What do you mean, what are you doing in the White House? Well, you didn't win. What are you doing? You're under ongoing investigation. You're being audited by several states. What are you doing there? Basic questions. This might be fun to play with for a few minutes. What would a five-year-old ask Brandon? Who are you? You know, what are you doing there? Kids will ask really basic questions. You know, why do I have to take this needle? So if you tell a five-year-old, right, that you have to take an injection. Why? Well, it'll keep you safe. You know, how? And it just put on that basic, how will it keep you safe? Well, it'll prevent you from getting COVID. And then you can go into statistics. Well, I'm not going to get it anyway.
But they don't think that. Kids don't think I'm not going to get it.
Again.
They think, you know, they get real fearful. Because you're going to get COVID. Well, what do they relate COVID with? Masks, you know, and people dying. You know, and that's a tough thing.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to five-year-olds for the answers, and I'm not trying to have a five-year-old understanding of this. All I'm trying to say is that five-year-olds have the ability to ask questions. They have not lost their ability.
Yes,
people
exactly.
If you can take the unrestrained ability of a five-year-old to ask questions and adapt that to you as an adult, that's what I'm saying. I don't expect five-year-olds to have the answers. God, no. I love the way they ask the questions, because they'll ask you the craziest things. You know, and the way they relate things is great. So if you can explain COVID to a five-year-old, well, I wouldn't even do that because they're just going to get scared. I'll stick with my original thesis. Ask questions as if you're 5 years old. Really basic things. What kills viruses? Why are we taking a vaccine when we can kill it? You know, there's a basic question. Oh, there's a question for Dr. Fascist. Why are you pushing vaccines when we already have treatments? Well, those treatments don't work. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah, let me show you. Oh, yeah? Well, then we'd be like an eight-year-old. Oh, yeah? Yeah? Oh, let me show you. I got 150,000 people here that were cured with early treatments. You got 700,000 killed because they didn't get early treatments. Who's right? Well, there's nothing difficult about any of this. Let's take a break. I'm going to have some other stories. I'm going to try and find the most disgusting story that pissed me off the most this morning. We'll go with that. Just remember, though, if you want to get on our press release list, we have the 25 bills to rock 2022. And if you want to start taking action, we're going to talk more about action as this week goes on. But if you want to get active, go to writeyourlaws.com. There's a bunch of legislation there that you can support at the local, state, and federal level. All right. And worldwide. Don't be shy about it worldwide. You know, you can take our bills, take them to your local organizations, political groups, your local representatives, and say, how can we adapt this to a parliamentary system? How can we adapt this to a monarchy? How can we, you know, if you're in Russia, you know, how do we get this past Putin? You know, we got to get a Russian caller. Gene, we need a Russian caller. We need to, there's certain countries we need to hear from. Iran. We need to clandestinely call us on the Skype line from Iran. We definitely need South Korea to report on North Korea. And we need somebody in Russia. You know, Russia's like our number five destination in the world after the United States. We know you're out there, Russia. Call, look at the broadcast page you're listening to right now. We got a Skype name. You call on the Skype. Call on the Skype name. It's CID.FDDBAC53A2909DE1. I have no idea what that means. But Pianki's on the line, so I'm going to hold off on my commercials for a bit. And see what his... So if you can ask questions like a five-year-old, Pianki, now that you're going
to... Morning.
You get the answers as an adult. Does that make sense? Have we lost our ability to ask basic questions? What do you think? Good morning, Pianki.
Where am I?
You're in the world.
Somebody tell me where I'm at.
Yeah. Huh. I'll tell you where
you're
at.
Good morning, Greg. Gene,
this is where
how
you are.
You? How are you?
Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything. That's where you are, dude. You're in the Action Radio zone.
Good morning.
Hey, look, you own to something. Let's talk about the most ridiculous stories we've heard all year.
Okay.
And man, we could go nonstop for the next 3 or 4 days because
yeah,
there
could,
was some
actually.
Doozies out there.
Well, I got.
I mean,
that.
There I was that, some doozies.
What's your favorite?
If it is this moment, the next moment, it won't no longer be the favorite.
Okay, well, let me throw this one out. All right, go ahead. I got a story for you when you're ready. I think you're going to like this one.
They want to give children to the custody of the state if the parent don't want them to have a vaccination. And also, mm-hmm. it's bringing into education, too. If mm-hmm. you don't want your child to have this type of teaching, this information, then we're going to mm-hmm. take your child.
Mm-hmm. This is why you need to end government schools. I keep saying it. You need to end government schools. I haven't talked to our webmaster about doing my blog. I want to get to my edition article, which is very long, but I think you'll find it fascinating. The solution, because you can't fight these government schools. They're not going to stop doing what they're doing. The government's not going to stop indoctrinating. The schools aren't going to stop, you know, giving lunch and breakfast and, you know, hotel rooms and, you know, all the other things they're doing. They're not going to stop indoctrinating. They're not going to stop anything. And I don't care how many school board people get replaced and how many people get voted out and how many things happen. The unions are going to be there. The government's going to be there because they get too much power out of it. They're trying to channel the next generation to be weaker than this generation, which is pretty disgusting when you think about it. You know, they're going to take the ability of five-year-olds, the natural ability of five-year-olds to ask questions and get rid of that and turn them into nice, compliant, blue-pill people that fit into their system. Don't ask questions. Don't rock the boat. You know, weed out the leaders.
It's just going to take the child right from under the bosom of the mother.
Mm-hmm. Well,
whoever
that's ridiculous. Think about this.
Well, kind of
why did the government want? Why did the government want? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's what they try to do to the Indians. They try to take the Indian kids and educate them out of their Indianness.
Well, what does Chief Dan Skyhorse always say? If you want to know what's going to happen to you, look what happened to American Indians. Schools were taken over. The education was taken over. The clothing, customs, religions were taken over. The spiritual beliefs were taken over. You'll believe this. Or else. Great. You know, so talk about cultural appropriation. That was cultural appropriation. All right, that was real cultural appropriation. So it's a fascinating thing. Well, here's a question for you, too, because I know we talk about Nigerian folks coming to the United States a lot. Is there cultural appropriation where Nigerians will come here and black Americans try to make Nigerian Americans black Americans? Simply by skin color.
Yeah. Black Americans try to make Nigerian Americans. They try to make Indian Americans who have dark skin, Eskimos mm-hmm. who have dark
right.
skin. Anything that doesn't have a lily white skin, they try to make black.
culture. In other words, the victim mentality, the welfare mentality, the white man's the root of all evil mentality. Because I don't, you know, Nigerians, I don't think come here with that mentality. First of all, I don't know how many white people there are in Nigeria, but the point is that there's a culture of success in Nigeria. There's a belief in individual achievement. I don't know if the same individual rights exist. I doubt it, because I don't know any country that has the same principles of freedom that we do. But in terms of advancement of families and education and accomplishment and, you know, private business and accomplishments and things like that, you don't have Nigerians don't have the same, you know, American victim mentality. So that has to be learned. Is there an effort in schools to make Nigerians get rid of the independence and sort of become victims? Speaking of appropriation in the schools.
Well, when they come, they don't even live in the same neighborhoods. You know, there's a Nigerian-American beauty contest, Ghanaian-American beauty contest.
Yeah.
Yes, crazy. That is. That means they don't even want to, they don't associate in those particular areas like you would think they would because of, quote, unquote, their skin color. So
it's valid. I never see the validity in doing anything about skin color because it just simply doesn't apply. And this is why I like to talk about these things, to show you all the reasons that it doesn't apply. Huh. So Nigerian
they don't identify as black neither. They either identify themselves as a language group or the particular tribe.
Yeah, it'd be interesting in sub-Saharan, northern South Africa, the whole region in the middle, if someone says, I'm black. Well, you know, like, so is 99% of the population. So that doesn't mean anything.
Well, no, and you would also have to include the northern Africa, too, the northeast corner, your Libya, your Egypt, because they aren't white.
They're Arab.
Yeah, and they would try to include them as being people of color. It goes from one down extreme to the other, I tell you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, see, here's the thing. I'm a person of color. I mean, my grandmother is part Egyptian. That makes me part Arabic. That makes me a person of color.
Well, you got rosy cheeks.
I know. I don't look it. So you'd have to have a racist judgment to not understand that I'm a person of color. If someone looks at me and doesn't accept that I'm a person of color based on my looks, then they don't know anything about it. Because it doesn't take a whole lot of color, apparently, to be a person of color. If you don't see it, it's there. You can't see my color? Mm-hmm. I'm a person of color. How can you not see that? How can you can't see my part Egyptian side? Walk like an Egyptian. Walk like an Egyptian. I love that. Walk like an Egyptian. I felt right at home. It's my heritage, man. It's my culture.
Well, there's many stories that we could talk about as being the most ridiculous that we've heard all year long.
All right, here's the one that I think is the most ridiculous. New York Post, December 24th, 2021. Dateline. Let me get the news theme, or should I play our teletype here? Let me see which one I find first. Here we go. Dateline. Let's get to the newsroom.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
New York Post, December 24th, 2021. Biden administration insists Americans are better off now than when Trump left. I'm sorry, that's funny. Mark Moore. And here it goes. It says, are you better off than you were 1 year ago? That's the message the White House is trying to convey in a year-end memo to Democrat lawmakers and other supporters, according to a new report from Axios. The memo, titled 2021 POTUS, delivered for working families. Oh, I can't wait for a State of the Union message. That's what, next month? I can see Biden getting up. All it's going to take is one Republican member of Congress to go, let's go, Brandon. And everybody's just going to erupt. It's going to be great. I would pay somebody, and I don't have a lot of money, but I would pay a member of Congress to yell that. In fact, well, let's get Trump to pay him. He's going to have to yell, let's go, Brandon, during the State of the Union. Anyway, so the article says that's the message. You know, I mean, how can you do that? How can you actually report something that? Well, I guess if you can lie to yourself, you can lie to anybody. The memo, titled 2021 POTUS Delivered for Working Families, illustrates in words and graphics what the Biden insurrection describes as a year of accomplishments, according to the outlet. The two-page document, oh, there you go. That in itself is funny. They took all about his accomplishments, and they got two pages. Man. The two-page document touts the COVID-19 vaccination program, which I will add killed more people than the non-vaccination program, by the way. Back to the article. The widespread reopening of schools, which they had to do anyway, they were ordered to by the courts, you know, and a decline in the unemployment rate and jobless claims. Well, they had to open those places up too. So here's a question for you. So what they're saying is Biden made things better because he got more people back to work. Well, the only reason people were out of work is to such a large extent, A, they were paid not to be there, and B, they were locked down. So how do you claim you've helped anything by simply ending a lockdown that was illegal to begin with? That's what they're saying. Look how much we improve things. It's like if a thief, you know, robs you, you know, they take your wallet and they steal $100 and then they give you back 10 bucks. Say, look, you've gained $10. Look how much richer you are. See, isn't it great that we met? You're now better off than you were before we met. That's the analogy I'm saying. Bianchi?
Well, you're right. You're counting people that was working that you put out of work. Now they're coming back to work. Is that just a miraculous thing? Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Now that's getting back to baseline. Here's another one. It also hails, this is the marvelous two-page document, the passage of two major spending bills this year, $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan and then $1.2 trillion bipartisan, I guess there was a couple of Republicans voted for it, infrastructure framework last month. So that's 2, that's 3.2, that's over $3 trillion. And that's a success in an economy with rampant inflation. So the successes are they put people back to work that they took out of work, and they spent money on us that they took from us. I'm sorry, I don't think that's a major accomplishment. Am I missing something?
Are those matching funds?
What do you mean matching funds?
Well, if you want to build a bridge, you pay half and the federal government pay half.
Well, that's a different thing. That's what, you know, but the federal government's taking money from you. See, the federal government doesn't pay anything. Government's tax. They take tax money, turn around,
well, actually,
and waste much of it, and give some back.
You're right. The taxes from gasoline,
uh-huh,
and so on and so on.
Yeah.
Half of that for a project, and the state pays the other half. So you can't take all of the credit because it's just not all of the cost is not coming from the federal government, from his bills.
No, but here's the thing, too. The way that most things are built, like infrastructure, roads and bridges, is municipal bonds. So municipal bonds are great because they create wealth and they create infrastructure and they create commerce. So they create wealth because, you know, if you invest your money, like the Golden Gate Bridge was built mostly with municipal bonds, right? So people bought bonds. In fact, the guy that started Bank of America made a fortune with bonds for the bridge. He also made a fortune because he trusted people after the 1906 earthquake. He loaned everybody money. Because I know he'll pay it back. He's the only person that loaned money because everybody else thought it was a bad risk. So he loans all his money, you know, and he makes it back plus interest once the economy improved. Made such a fortune, he started Bank of America. It used to be the Bank of Italy.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah,
this is a success
right.
story. So loaning money makes money because when people pay it back, you get money from the interest on the money that they borrowed. You get money on the wealth from what the money was spent on. See, the Golden Gate Bridge incredibly increased commerce. It increased tourism, if nothing else. You know, you look at the bridges, the roads, the structures, the things that the sports stadiums, the convention halls, all these infrastructure things that are built with municipal bonds. They all create wealth because of all the events that are held in them and the commerce that goes over them and all the trucks in the supply chain. You know, so this is how you create. So municipal bonds are a great way to invest and build things locally because the money, you know, invests locally and actually creates wealth. So money can create wealth or money can destroy wealth. You know, if money is printed, it's a destruction of wealth. If money is churned through the government and given back to you, that's a destruction of wealth because they'd take more of it in the first place before they could give it back because they always give back less than they take. So if they take $100 from you and give you back $85 and call that a benefit, no, they've cost $15 to do that process. So you've had a net loss. This is why government spending never works. It's always a net loss. They always lose more money than they spend because they had to take it in the first place.
Well, it's just
so
like water
systems
in St. Louis County.
Yeah.
In St. Louis County, they passed bonds in order to replace the water line. It asked the federal government for everything.
Mm-hmm.
The people passed the bond issue, and they replaced the water line.
Yeah, state bonds are different, though. State bonds, in fact, California, they had a problem. They ran up.
There's a municipal bond.
Oh, municipal.
The same way
yeah.
to go about building new schools.
Mm-hmm.
Same way to go about building new schools.
Yeah,
the bond rating is based on the condition of the area. If the houses are well kept, if the desire to live there is high, if crime is low, and so on and so on, well, you can get a more favorable bond rate because that which is backing the bond is favorable itself. People want to come contribute to it. But if it's just the opposite, you're never going to get a bond.
No, because if there's less chance of you paying it back, why should people loan you money? It's going to cost you more money if you're a higher risk. That only makes sense. That's the free market at work. But the state bonds, see, California had a problem. They issued too many bonds. They issued bonds that they never spent, and the debt that they incurred, because once you issue bonds, you're issuing debt. So you're saying, we can incur this debt for these municipal bonds. It's only going to get paid back when the infrastructure thing is built. So what California was doing was issuing bond after bond after bond for water projects and all kinds of things. They weren't building them, but they kept the debt. And I'm not sure why they did that, either incompetence or somebody was making money off it. But you can have too much of a good thing. But the other thing this says is interesting is that absent from the document, the two-page document on the wonders of the Brandon insurrection, is any mention of inflation, which is at a 39-year high. What was 39 years ago? This is 2021. So that would have been, what was 40 years ago? 1981? 1982? Well, that was right before the Reagan recovery. So unless I missed my years, but yeah. I said, nor is there any discussion of an increase in COVID-19 cases across the country as the Omicron variant becomes the dominant strain. The collapse of the multi-billion dollar Build Back Better plan after Senator Joe Manchin pulled his support, or the tragic aftermath of the botched U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan, what I call the Biden surrender. So that's the most ridiculous story, is the fact that Biden says, yeah, you're better off now than under Trump. Things are great. Do you have another story, Pianki? I've got one I think Gene's going to like once I find it here. You have another story? Or should I
I think it's kind of... I'm just going for me.
Okay.
I'm just going from head. I ran out of pencils and paper trying to keep up with these stories all year.
Okay. What do you think of Desmond Tutu? I'd just be curious. Desmond Tutu passed away. Rabble rouser, Anglican bishop. The African National Congress hated him because he was black enough.
He was an Anglican bishop.
Yeah. White people didn't like him. Go ahead.
I hear bits and pieces about him from time to time. So, you know, everybody has a purpose, and purpose can be very good at times.
Well, here's the thing about Desmond Tutu. I remember when he was doing his rabble-rousing, trying to end apartheid, and we all congratulated him for him, and he was doing a great thing. He's kind of like the Martin Luther King of South Africa, and did an incredible job. But it's interesting that the very thing that the left condemns, in other words, apartheid, the separation of the races, is the very thing they're doing now. You know, not only the separation of races, but the separation of health status. So in other words, if you want to be in the club, if you want to be normal, if you want to be left alone by the government, then you have to take this shot into your arm. And if you do that, you're okay. You're one of us. It's kind of like the religion. You know, it's sort of like, you know, at least communion with Catholics is voluntary. But this one, they're trying to make mandatory. So it's mandatory communion. It's mandatory, injection. And then you're okay. Then you're one of us. Then you don't have to suffer the consequences of being, you know, a divergent or the Hunger Games or things like that. You know, it's fascinating. But anyway, so he was a cool guy, but I think in later years, he kind of lost his way. But he was a real rabble rouser in his day. So you know, I congratulate him for the work that he did.
His work and others to eliminate apartheid was a great thing.
Yep.
No shortcomings there at all. But of course, like you say, there comes a time when some of the things that they uphold and support, it's just really detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
Like forcing everybody. I think we've said it many times, and I think it's almost becoming a dead horse because they keep wanting to resuscitate this thing about these shots, these vaccinations. And I still contend if people want to, go ahead. If they don't, leave them alone.
I don't think anybody takes it seriously anymore. It's hard to know. The story here, Kamala Harris, security. They say mistakenly, but I don't think so. I think in what people say casually, and these little throwaway lines, what people say, I think those are sometimes the most meaningful. I got to play a couple things before Dr. gets here, just to be on the safe side. And then what I want to do is go into Kamala Harris's, you know, does she really think that democracy is the greatest threat to national security? It's kind of interesting for a Marxist, huh? Considering that they came in via Marxism and not democracy. Be right back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can increase foot and website traffic. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com, BESMALLBUSINESS. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. It contains caffeine, taurine, B vitamins, and potassium. You make your energy drink yourself. Here's how. Add one pack to a standard half liter water bottle or 16 ounce glass to create a full power energy drink. No sugar, no calories, no stirring, no shaking. Strikeforce energy drinks come in original, grape, lemon, and orange. Each flavor pack is a liquid that adds an explosion of flavor to any beverage. Here's the best part. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. That's WYL. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, get a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeforceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Who says we don't have fun here? There we go. I got to talk to Eric, our webmaster. I got to get my Greg's blog section so I can start posting the articles from Intellectual Conservative that the site got hacked and we lost. We sort of lost a bunch of articles. I always keep the original text though, so I can put them up again. Anyway, so my second most ridiculous story comes from Conservative Brief. Kamala Harris mistakenly says democracy is a threat to national security. Well, if you look at the context of this, when the beach ball from hell stops spinning. I'll tell you. Come on, let me scroll down. You know that spinning ball of color that tells you you can't do something? It's there. It's not me scrolling to my article, which is really disgusting. So let's talk for a minute. Oh, where'd it go? Beach ball from hell. Yep. Oh, now it's to the bottom of the article. Great. Let me scroll down. I had this all set up. I mean, I actually organized today. All right. Well, do you think she said it by accident or do you think she really believes it? Who wants to take it?
I don't know if you know it, Greg.
Jackie, you're
breaking up.
You're there.
Jane, do you hear him breaking up?
Yeah, you just started breaking up, Greg. I don't know what's going on.
You got to get that fixed, Greg.
Well, because I'm getting the beach ball from hell. That's why. This website's not working. Hang on. Ugh. I'm going to scrap this. Let's get rid of it. It's not letting me get. This may take. I'm going to have to wait my computer to sort itself out. That's one of the problems with doing this. All right. What else can I find for you? Out of that. Beach ball with my screen over. Just bear with me for a little bit longer. See if I make this one work. No, it's not working either. Uh-oh, we're having a little glitches today. Well,
what about the strife between Pocahontas and Elon Musk? You hear about that?
Yeah, that's a kind of want to say a weird dispute because it is. I would have never thought the two of them would get into it, but yeah.
What's come upon this Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren? And she's attacking Elon Musk.
Right.
He's a private business that's doing it better than government, providing jobs, opportunity, adding to the technology, adding to the nation's status in that particular industry, that is space and exploration, and she's attacking him.
I know, it's crazy, and think that, you know, about him not paying his fair share of taxes and whatever. It's like, and what is she doing? You know, it's like, oh my God, yeah.
Well, you know, tell you the truth, the people who's the performance that he has attained in the areas that he's specializing in and also opening up for a lot rather than a few, the taxes that he's paying should go toward further innovation.
Right, right.
Innovation would give us an innovative edge over the rest of the world, which
right.
We have failed drastically behind. You shouldn't be paying any tax. Put that money
right.
toward those innovations rather than going to the government and begging them, trying to get it back.
Right. Well, but also, you know, with the taxes, she's the one that has a say in how the taxes, not even taxes, how the American money that are being spent, and look how wasteful it is. That's a sad thing. It's like she shouldn't even open her mouth and criticize someone else. It's like, wow. Yeah, our politicians are just a piece of work, that's for sure. They think they're high and mighty, yet they're just very sad, very sad.
Yeah.
They are not what makes this country great, that's for sure. Maybe in the past you could say that, but you can't say that anymore. They each have their own agenda.
You're absolutely
mostly,
right, Jane.
Mostly it's just to line their own pocketbooks. I mean, if you look at how much they make as a senator, congressman, whatever, and when they go into office, how much money they have, and then how much money they have when they get out, wow, that is sad. You even look at Biden with what he did all his life, being in politics and how much money he has. How did he get all that money? It wasn't because of good investments. It wasn't because of knowledge.
You make a great point there, Gene. Good observation. And you know some more crazy stories you can see out here. You see where in many of these cases with these victims
okay,
and
back.
These perpetrators.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
where'd
hold
my
on,
show
let's,
go?
Let Bianchi finish his comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead, Bianchi.
Yeah,
I was going to say that you've seen a lot of court cases come through where there's nothing at all applied to the accountability of the criminal. the things that they've done that led up to the moment that's at trial right then and there.
Right.
And one thing, this latest case with in Minnesota with the female police officer Porter of accidentally shooting Deontay Rice. And there's nothing at all mentioned about him not being accountable for all the things that led up to the moment that he was in the position that he is. That is driving a car with expired license plates, driving a car with his own personal license being expired, his performance on the road, making right-hand turns out of left-turn lanes, and resisting arrest after agreeing to the arrest. And also the things that was done that caused him to have an arrest warrant, not a bench warrant, an arrest warrant, when he tried to rob a female in an apartment where they let him and his buddy spend the night until the next morning, whereas they could go out when things was open. So all these things that people do that lead up to a moment that all of a sudden is on trial by the nation, no one's taking into effect them not being accountable.
Right, right, exactly. And yeah, I don't know a lot about the case, but the sad thing is she was on the force for, or a police officer for like 26 years. And now all of a sudden they're charging her all this stuff. And it's like, you know, if she was such a bad person, she would have had a lot more on her record, you know, a lot more complaints, a lot more issues. It's like, it's sad that people are like, well, she couldn't have made a mistake. She's been doing that a long time. She knows. You know, the thing is, when you get into a tense situation, I don't want to say do the right thing. You know, it's like she could have, I just know sometimes when I'm talking or doing things, I could be doing things for 20 years and all of a sudden I'm like, I forgot how to do this. And so it's like you could have that moment where you do reach with the wrong arm. And all the other times, yes, you reach for the right arm. Who knows? But it's like, and what they think her jail time will be, that will be interesting too, because some people are saying they want even more time. She needs to be, you know, in jail even longer. And I'm just like, wow. So the criminals are the ones now that have all the rights, because it doesn't matter what they do. You know, they have no accountability. It's everybody else that has to attune. And, you know, I don't want to say it was right or wrong, whatever, but I sort of thought that when you get in a situation like that, and you go, well, she's a police officer, she should handle it better. It's like, wow. I don't know. Just sad. Just very sad.
It sounds like you got a great discussion going. And like I say, I'm back here on my cell phone, which is kind of weird. But my screen froze up and the time stopped and everything went kind of weird. I want to continue this probably tomorrow. I've got to, well, maybe even later in this hour. We'll see how long Dr. Pryor wants to stay. But he's with us for right now. And so I want to take this call, and we shall be right back with our national security report.
What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but my screen froze up and I was trying to pull some articles for a discussion, and it froze me out of it, which it seems to do whenever the signal is broken. So I'm on my cell phone, but as far as everything else goes, we're still pretty much normal. I can still push buttons, and away we go. So first of all, sir, how are you feeling this week?
Any improvement?
Well,
I hope.
Well, well enough to call in on, to your show. I mean, okay. My recovery is happening slowly. I mean, I was practically cut in half during this surgery, but I don't want to bore your audiences with that. The reason I'm calling in is because I wanted to continue our conversation that we had last week about this enormous crisis that is happening in Europe and Asia, that, you know, Americans are so distracted by the holidays and by various domestic matters that are happening. And this has gotten very little attention. It got some attention on the Sunday talk shows. But this really could be it. I mean, you and I have talked in the past on your show often about the theoretical possibility of losing World War III without war, and about
right.
a transition to a new world order dominated by the evil empires, by Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, you know, without war. That it could actually be happening while we are here celebrating Christmas and New Year's, distracted by our domestic issues. We could be on the threshold of this happening. To go back and to explain what's going on to those who may not have listened last week, you know, is that Russia has massed enormous armies on the border of Ukraine and NATO for the second time this year. And Washington and NATO officialdom are extremely concerned that this time Putin may invade. And not only invade and take over Ukraine, annex Ukraine, you know, the legions of Russia are powerful enough that they could conquer the frontline NATO states in 72 hours if they wanted to. Simultaneously, you know, China is building up the capabilities and threatening to invade Taiwan and annex. They've already annexed the South China Sea as far as China is concerned, but they are really accelerating their militarization of the South China Sea to make that a fact, so that they will have and by the way, that's not irrelevant to taking over Taiwan either, because in order for us to come to the defense of Taiwan, we've got to transit the South China Sea. And it looks like they're preparing for exactly that. And Washington, another thing you and I have talked about many times on your show, is the fact that Washington has been blind to the what I call the new axis, you know, that there is this alliance between Russia and China, North mm-hmm. Korea and Iran. They are all working together. And only now, you know, has it dawned on Washington officialdom that at least the Russia-China, the Sino-Russo alliance is real, you know, because they themselves are noticing that, you know, if Russia goes into Ukraine, China's going to go after Taiwan. And it still has
well, are they coordinating it?
North Korea and Iran are also probably going to yeah. commit aggression at the same time, so that we would have to deal yeah. with four theaters instead of just one. All of our military mm-hmm. plans are based on a single theater of operations. And in the particular circumstances that we are facing at this moment, we can't even win in the one theater. All of our war games, we've had at least 18 war games that show us losing every one of them in a confrontation with China over Taiwan. And likewise, we've had numerous war games, including not only the Defense Department, but by the RAND Corporation as well, showing that Russia consistently can conquer Ukraine and overrun the NATO frontline states in 72 hours, and we can't do anything about it. So, you know, it's a real dire situation. And my concern is that Washington is going to play this completely wrong. All of the policies that we are currently pursuing are, where Ukraine is concerned, are based on confrontation with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the neocons would actually have us fight for Ukraine. And there have been some articles written in People claiming that we have that we are obliged by treaty, by the Bucharest memo, to go to the defense of Ukraine, which would involve us directly in a losing war that could become a nuclear war. The mainstream view in the Republican and Democrat side is less sanguine and would say, well, you know, we're not obliged to defend Ukraine. They're not a NATO member state, but we can make it as difficult as possible for Russia by, you know, by arming Ukraine and feeding, you know, advanced military technologies to Ukraine if Russia invades, to make it as costly as possible for Russia to do that. And I think that's a mistaken, you know, that seems to be the spectrum of thinking right now. All of it confrontational. And I think that that is a doomed to fail strategy too. I mean, what do they think the Russians are going to do? Just allow themselves to be caught up in a protracted guerrilla war in Ukraine and allow Poland and the Baltic states to be pathways for arming the Ukrainians? It's inviting the Russians or encouraging them to invade the frontline NATO states too, so that they can completely isolate Ukraine. And, you know, if something like that were to happen, the other context, the big important thing that has happened that we were talking about last week, you know, is that Russia has offered a peace treaty. And and what I was interested in, because what was the Western reaction going to be to this peace treaty? And now we know, at least on the Sunday show, is pretty much across the board, everybody is rejecting the, and I put quotations around it too, because I don't want to make it sound like the Russians are the good guys, all right? You know, their so-called peace treaty, you know, would require NATO to promise that it's not going to expand further eastward and will not include Ukraine or former or nations that formerly belonged to the Soviet Union. It would require a NATO promise that no missiles will be based in NATO territory that can reach Moscow in short flight times. It would include
the Iron Curtain again. Is this the redrawing of the Iron Curtain? That's what it sounds like.
Include agreement that neither side, NATO or Russia, will conduct major military exercises in the border regions, you know, because, you know, we're always concerned about these exercises possibly becoming, and there are other things. I mean, like they want the withdrawal of all tactical nuclear weapons from European NATO, you know, and I'm not saying that my position is not that, oh, we should accept the Russian peace, so-called peace treaty. And in fact, it might not even be sincere. You know, it might not even be sincere. It might be just a pretext. And that's what many are saying, that the so-called peace treaty is just a pretext so that the Russians can say, well, we tried to negotiate with these guys, but you wouldn't listen. And therefore, we had no choice but to go into Ukraine. Yeah. And that's, and it could be. I mean, it's so late it could well be just a pretext, and they're not at all serious about it. But I think that some effort must be made, because it's better to negotiate and stall for time, if nothing else, than to fight a losing war, get involved in a war that could even become a nuclear war. This is a real, very serious crisis involving Russia and China and the possibility of a nuclear world war, you know, that could... That's what we could be facing in the new year, while we're all enjoying the holidays here. It's just also it might also not be a coincidence that all this is happening during the holidays. You know, the Russia and China know, you know, Washington is out to lunch during these holidays. You know. Not just in terms of what our public attention is, but literally, you know, a lot of the Washington bureaucracy in the intelligence and national security areas and the Defense Department is literally home for the holidays, you know? And that's just a fact of life that's always sort of happened. So
Pearl Harbor, the Tet Offensive.
Yeah,
how many
right,
things
exactly.
took place on holidays? These all took
right.
place on holidays.
Exactly, you know? And so this is an extremely dire situation. It could also be an opportunity, though. I mean, I know one of the reasons for them not wanting to negotiate with the Russians over the Ukraine under these circumstances, you know, is because it violates the concept of international law and a rules-based world order that the United States has been endeavoring to build since 1945. You know, the idea is, oh, we're not going to yield to blackmail. You know, you guys want to negotiate a so-called peace treaty even while you've got a gun pointed at our head and at the head of Ukraine. And, of course, most Americans and most people in the West intuitively agree with that. And, you know, it's a flagrant violation, again, of the so-called rules-based international order, you know, that would rely on international law, adherence to international norms, like not invading other countries, you know, and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, it's not 1945 anymore. It's not even 1980. And the United States and its allies have failed to maintain the military, the nuclear, the technological, and the economic wherewithal that underwrote that rules-based international order that period of time that we might call Pax Americana, you know, that extended from 1945 until the 1990s, you know, where the United States basically was, you know, the leader of the free world and the dominant actor in the globe, and was leading the way toward free political and economic systems everywhere. I mean, that's gone. You know,
that
depended upon certain physical realities in terms of military power and economic power and technological advanced technological edges over your adversaries that we have over the past 30 years allowed to wither away and vanish. And I think Washington and the West needs to reorient its thinking away from this idea of preserving the Pax Americana, because I don't think we can do it. I don't think we've got the strength to do it anymore. And what we need to do is buy time to rebuild our strength. And that means reverting to an older way of thinking, the 19th century balance of power type politics, where you do have to negotiate with the bad guys. And it isn't based on international law, and it's based on the idea that might makes right, unfortunately, that you have to recognize spheres of influence. That's what the Russians want. That's what the Chinese want, too. They want us to recognize that they're in charge of the South China Sea, that Russia is in charge of the former space that used to be occupied by the USSR and maybe even the Warsaw Pact. And their ambitions are not limited to that. You know, they want to establish, but their step toward global domination, their first step toward global domination is to achieve that recognition. And I think that we don't have the strength now to deny that to them. The good thing about it is that it would give us the chance to hold off a world war, you know, and making these concessions to them, I think are necessary. And again, I know my conservative colleagues would be shouting me down and accusing me of appeasement, you know, to be saying these things, right? Well, appeasement is better than losing World War III. And having a world order quickly taken over and dominated by totalitarian systems, you know, I'm not for appeasing these guys forever. And also some of the demands are not unreasonable. You know, we never should have, in my view, we never should have expanded NATO to the east in the first place. I've said before on this show how when I had the portfolio for NATO enlargement on the House Armed Services Committee, when that was my job,
I remember,
I advised Congress against that because it was going to make this very situation that we're in today inevitable. You know, you cannot. Our main goal in the aftermath of the Cold War should have been to incorporate Russia into the community of Western nations, to make them a real strategic partner. And, you know, the Clinton administration blew that, and then the George W. Bush administration by NATO expansion blew that again. It made it inevitable that Russia was going to become our enemy and that there would be a new Cold War and that we would push Russia into the arms of China and create this Sino-Russo axis that, you know, that is a military bloc of unprecedented power that we've never faced before and that we can't beat, not in the theaters that are of concern at this moment. So, you know, we need to unravel that. I think negotiation and thinking in terms of the way we used to think about international relations in the 19th century is where Washington needs to go, where we do think of spheres of influence and balance of power politics. And our new strategy should be based on splitting Russia from China. You know, I think even at this late date, it may not be, we might be able to achieve that if we were willing to make some concessions to Russia. And some of these things are not unreasonable. I don't think it's unreasonable to stop expanding NATO eastward. We shouldn't have done it in the first place, you know? Imagine if our roles were reversed, and imagine if the United States had lost the Cold War, okay? And the USSR and the Warsaw Pact were the dominant military economic bloc in the world. And suppose the Soviet Union decided to start expanding the Warsaw Pact and took over all of European NATO, Canada, Mexico, California, and Texas, and Oregon, okay, and included them. And would Washington sit back and regard that with equanimity as if nothing is wrong and this is, and they're okay with that? Of course not. We would feel extremely threatened, and we don't have the bloody history that Russia has of being invaded, you know, from so many directions and having and losing tens of millions of lives in wars over the course of history. Even we, an optimistic people that always look on the bright side, would feel extremely threatened by those developments. Well, in effect, that's what we've done in reverse with Russia. So I don't think that some of their demands are at all unreasonable. You know, I do think it would be prudent, you know, to stop NATO enlargement, to recognize we had the INF Treaty. We used to believe in it, you know, up until just a couple of years ago. Don't think it would be unreasonable to say, okay, we're not going to put missiles in Europe that are going to be able to reach Moscow in 5 minutes. If we do that, by the way, the Russians are talking about putting missiles in Venezuela and Cuba again. You have to put us in an equivalent threatening situation, you know. The military exercises, I actually think their proposal to not have big military exercises, major military exercises on the border regions is a very good one, because those exercises always make me nervous. The possibility for miscalculation is increasingly high as the international tensions rise between us. So at least some of the major requests or suggestions or demands, actually, that are in the Russian peace treaty are reasonable, but they're not being taken. They're being rejected out of hand right now by Washington, by NATO. General Stoltenberg just this past week said, "No way, we're not going to." You know, NATO is a sovereign organization, and we have every right to expand it as far as we want to. I mean, this is
a sovereign organization. What do you think it is? Isn't it their own country?
Yeah,
like
well,
European Union. It's an independent security agency.
Well, it's
now
a collection of it's a collection of sovereign nations, and
yeah, but
and
who runs
NATO
it?
Was you know, right, but we do, and the European heads, you know, as well. But we basically right now are at a point where we're saying, well, we don't want to give an inch. We don't want to negotiate anything. And I think that's a huge mistake. And it's really going to be a thing to see what happens. Now, you know, will Russia actually invade Ukraine? Another thing we're threatening is economic sanctions, in addition to arming the Ukrainians to impose more and more economic sanctions. This reminds me so much of how World War II got started, when the Roosevelt administration decided to punish Japan for its long war against China by cutting off oil and imposing enormous economic sanctions on Japan, which basically pushed Japan into a corner. You know, we believed that would be a way of resolving the issue peacefully, you know, that we could get the Japanese to back off peacefully. But we completely miscalculated in that, because totalitarian states, they actually don't respect sanctions. They see that as a form of weakness. You know, they respect military power. And it sent the wrong signal to Japan and put Japan in a situation where they really arguably had no choice. They had no choice if they want. They either had to, in effect, surrender to us without war and give up their dreams of taking over Asia and establishing their East Asia co-prosperity sphere, or go to war against us and roll the dice on being able to achieve their dreams of empire. And they chose the latter. And military dictatorships will usually be willing to roll those military dice, because that's what they're about. That's what they do best. But anyway, I'll get off.
Yeah, but they thought that was going to end the war. They destroyed our battleships and then destroyed our fleet. That's why I think that it was well known that the Japanese were coming, because the aircraft carriers weren't there. What a coincidence. They destroyed our World War One battleships. And I guess the theory goes that, you know, we would be so damaged, we would let Japan do what they wanted in the South Pacific and just, you know, go home. Well, that was a severe miscalculation, but that's arrogance. I think
the admiral, the Japanese admiral, I think his name was Nagumo, who was in charge. The Japanese can make bureaucratic mistakes too. The guy who was in charge of the aircraft carriers to attack Pearl Harbor was not a big fan of the theory of carrier aviation. He was actually a battleship guy, and he was extremely cautious, and he didn't let the second wave go out. You know, that left the oil fields, the oil tank. We had the oil tanks for the fueling the Pacific Fleet, but especially the dry docks. He didn't destroy the dry docks, and he was supposed to do that. And that's what had he done that, even with the carriers, and they had a lot more carriers than we did, even with the survival of those carriers, it could have changed the whole course of the war if he had gone with that second wave, you know, because we weren't able to, the fact that he failed to destroy the dry docks especially and didn't take out the fuel supplies, you know, enabled us within about 6 months to repair a lot of the damage. And we didn't have to abandon Hawaii as a base of naval operations, because it had all the fuel and the infrastructure in there that he was supposed to have taken out with that second wave. He's the same guy, by the way, that screwed up at Midway. You know, so, you know, sometimes even the military dictatorships, you know, you get lucky and you have an incompetent admiral or an incompetent general who, well, sometimes it makes you think that maybe it's true that God looks after fools, little children, and the United States of America. Certainly seemed to have been the case in World War II. You know, Otto von Bismarck.
Interesting. Okay. But what you've been describing here, I've been sort of taking a bunch of notes, but what it really comes down to is sort of like the yin and yang of arrogance and ignorance. And they seem to be playing out both at the same time. So you've got this arrogance that we can win the Cold War and maintain control of the world and have this big Pax Americana. I remember G. Gordon Liddy talking about that one day. I actually met him. It was kind of interesting. But he used to talk about that on his show. And in order to maintain control of the world, you're also responsible for the world. But the ignorant side is to think that that you actually do have control when you don't. I mean, we could win the Cold War but not have control over China, what happens inside China, or what happens inside Russia, or what happens inside Germany or France, as to how much money they're going to pay to NATO. You know, so this whole idea of control is an illusion. Nation building is an illusion. You know, the arrogance that, we're going to defeat Russia, we'll show them, we'll keep Ukraine for us. Well, it's not in our vital interest. It's in their vital interest. Ukraine is vital to the Ukraine's vital to Russia. Taiwan is vital to China's communist interests. Where's our vital interest? We don't have one. So people don't defend things that aren't in their vital interest. I don't care how much they make political speeches. But if you said, as you said, if China said, well, we think California is our word expansion here. We're gonna protect California from all you conservatives. You know, we'll save California. You know, a Marxist bastion who believes like we do, or whatever the pretense is. That would be one of our vital interests. We'd go to war over California as much as we distaste California, whereas we wouldn't go to war over Taiwan. It's up to Taiwan to defend Taiwan, which comes to my philosophy. We should give them 100 million. Well, we should give them 1 million AR-15s. I mean, that's what I would do. You know, and make it impossible for China to occupy Taiwan. But it's arrogance and ignorance. You look at any policy that you've mentioned, from China to for the Japanese Empire to, those of the people that want to go to war for anything, you know, in our country. It always comes down to some combination of arrogance and ignorance. That's the way it looks to me.
Right. No, I agree. You know, you've got these neocons who have been, or ivory tower type strategists, who live in the Pentagon and the State Department and in the think tanks around the Washington, D.C. area, who think in terms of these abstractions, you know, Pax Americana, the rules-based international order. And to them, that has such a reality and has such an importance that they are willing to commit us to circumstances where we have to go to nuclear war for a country like Estonia, you know, that most Americans can't even find on a map. And it's going to be even worse if NATO continues to expand eastward. You know, in Partnership for Peace members, this is the interim step before you become a NATO member, includes almost all the former Soviet republics that surround Washington, countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, okay? You know, someone once said, maybe it was a Russian, but he's right, that you should never promise to go to nuclear war for a country you can't find on the map. And that's in effect what we have been doing since the end of the Cold War.
Reagan should have disbanded NATO after the Berlin Wall came down. You know, said, okay, we've done our bit. Let's declare victory and go home. And said, France, Germany, all you countries there, hey, you're on your own. You're grown up, you know. And talking about spheres of influence, I mean, these are longstanding countries with thousands of years of tradition, as does China and Japan and Korea. You know, we're the new guys. So it's kind of arrogant to think that we can control the world and patrol the world. But these countries, they have their traditions. Let them defend themselves. The best thing we could have done is, as I say, declare victory and go home. How can we never do that? How can we never take the simple way out? In Iraq, after we took out, and I didn't agree with that war at all, but at least we could have gone to Baghdad, got rid of Saddam Hussein, declared victory, and gone home. Afghanistan, rout the Taliban for a year, year and a half, you know, make them nothing, and then go home. We got a problem not going home.
And it results in us overextending ourselves, sort of the way the Roman Empire did, so that we, I think people get their heads stuck in an earlier time frame and think these people in the ivory tower like it's still 1945 or even that it's still 1980, you know, a time when the U.S. had the economic and military and technological wherewithal, that we had such advantages that we could get away with that sort of thing. But that's not the situation today by any means. You know, the balance of power is shifted against us. And, you know, we just don't have the wherewithal to maintain Pax Americana anymore. And not only the basics like that, I don't even think we've got the wise political leadership, you know. We don't have Eisenhower's and Truman's and Ronald Reagan's and John F. Kennedy's and Nixon's anymore running the show for us, you know. We've got a ship of fools in Washington that can't, you know, I wouldn't trust these guys. I mean, even if the balance of power wasn't so obviously against us, just looking at, for example, the way they bungled Afghanistan and have bungled, you know, when's the last time we've actually won a war? It's been a long time, you know,
World War II.
The Pentagon has actually succeeded, you know, in winning a war. You know, we're just asking to lose World War III with this ship of fools in Washington
that
we've got now. We need to buy time.
Yeah.
We need to buy time so that we can rebuild our strength, get new political leadership in there, and maybe even we may even need to transition to a whole new strategy, a Fortress America strategy. But what you didn't say, and I agree with you, by the way, about NATO. You know, had we done that and pulled out of NATO, you know, then the NATO states would have been responsible for protecting themselves, and maybe we wouldn't have to be. We wouldn't have created the opportunity for them to become these corrupt social welfare states. I mean, they did that under the umbrella
like
of American
it's
military
like military
power.
Welfare. It's a perfect example. Well, if we could, you're over a half hour. I don't know how you feel. If you want to take off any time, you've definitely given us a great report, real summation of what's going on. But if you got a few more minutes, I would ask, how would you structure a sphere of influence for us? Now, let's get some reasonable expectations of what we can do. We can defend ourselves. We can stop invasions of Canada and Mexico and the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. So we can protect around us, you know, let's say 1,000 miles in any direction of the continental United States, and including Alaska around that too. So we can protect that. Other than that, we shouldn't be protecting anything, quite frankly. NATO is European.
Well, I think,
you know,
yes.
South China Sea is a Japan and South Korea problem, and Australia.
People may not like to hear it. People may not like to hear it, but, you know, the reality is it's always got to be based on the reality of what is your military capability. What is your what can you actually do? You know?
Yeah. So what should be our sphere of influence?
You know, I think the sphere of influence that you're talking about, based where we are today, you know, is pretty accurate. The only way we can protect the extended Pax Americana kind of American empire that we've got right now is with nuclear weapons. But that's a bluff. And I think Russia and China know it's a bluff, that we're not going to be willing to sacrifice ourselves, nor would our nuclear-armed allies, France or Britain, be willing to sacrifice themselves for something like, let's say, Lithuanian sovereignty. If Russia, would we really resort to nuclear weapons if Russia takes Ukraine and then invades the NATO frontline states? I think it's been a lie, you know, the idea that we would do that. And we were able to get away with it because Russia was in a period of weakness, and under Boris Yeltsin for the years of the Clinton administration, you know, it looked at the top like they were democratic reformers, and we sort of just forgot about Russia and said, they'll come along, you know, and it's in their interests to join the West, and they took their eye off the ball and blew that opportunity. And it paved the way for the rise of Yeltsin and the new Cold War and Russian revanchism, you know, which of course NATO enlargement made that inevitable. But I think in this balance of power issue, one of the things that, if we think of it in those terms, that we would have an opportunity, our main goal, our main foreign policy goal should be, and I'll leave you with this thought, is to split the Sino-Russia alliance, that we need to split Russia off from them. There are two reasons. if to neutralize Russia so that they don't see us as a threat anymore is vitally important because of those two actors. Russia right now is the most dangerous. You know, Putin has invested heavily to build this war machine, and he's only got an economy the size of Venezuela. So it's not like he can maintain this military and maybe not even the nuclear advantage forever. It's got a time limit on it. You know, eventually it's going to start turning obsolete. So he's either got to use it or lose it, which is a good reason for us to be talking with them and negotiating with them and not goading them into using their war machine. The second thing is I think Russia does have a more natural interest in aligning with the West than with China, because China, in the long run, is going to be a much more of a threat to Russia than we would be. You know, that the Siberia, you know, is an enormously tempting. Russia and China fought about that before. They almost went to nuclear war over it in the 60s, okay? And I'm sure the Russians haven't forgotten that. So I think it's not unrealistic that we could, through smart negotiation, recognizing that Russia has legitimate spheres of influence, you know, making some concessions, that we could split them off from China. And China, I think, would then be isolated. And I think they're too smart there because they have a big economy and they think in terms of decades and even centuries. You know, if they were to lose the strong right arm that is Russia, you know, I think that they would pause and they would hold back in terms of starting aggression. I think the whole reason this current situation is so dangerous is because you've got this Russia-China alliance that Washington has only now woken up to recognize. And all of this, if we were to do this, return to, there was a great Austrian statesman named Metternich, who in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars introduced, well, these ideas have always been around, balance of power, spheres of influence, but he kind of more formalized them, what was called the Concert of Europe, even though the nations of Europe in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars had many different interests. By working out balance of power politics and spheres of influence and the like, he basically created a situation where peace was maintained in Europe. I mean, they didn't have another world war until 1914, from 1815 to 1914. So,
yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, not bad, especially considering where we are
had
today.
We had a war in the 1860s, yeah. Yeah.
Sure, and there were wars in Europe. There was the Germany fought France in the Franco-Prussian War, and there was a war between Austria and Germany. But those were relatively small wars compared to the Napoleonic Wars. They weren't world wars, okay? So it wasn't perfect in terms of maintaining peace. But it was pretty good compared to what happened in the 20th century when we shifted to Wilsonian idealism and abandoned the idea of balance of power politics, which got a bad name because of the outbreak of World War I. You know, people, if you look at a different perspective, the balance of power lasted for a century. And then how well did Wilsonian idealism do? Well, we had two world wars in quick succession. When the balance of power approach to international relations was abandoned. But anyway, hopefully, what I'm asking for is an enormous transition. I don't know if it's possible, but it's necessary. I'm asking for an enormous reimagining of how we do international relations in Washington, you know, to recognize that we can't support the Pax Americana rules-based world order anymore. You know, we just don't have the capability to do it, and we've got to transition to a whole new way of thinking, actually an older way of thinking, you know, involved in what you might call the realist approach, not the idealist approach, but one based on spheres of influence, balance of power, and that's the best way of preserving peace for long enough give us an opportunity to rebuild our military and economic capabilities, which are nowhere near what they need to be right now to prevail if there were a world war. And I'll leave you with that thought. And
now that's wonderful. Listen, there's more to talk about. I think if you can propose some ideas and outline, if you can even make a world map with the spheres as you see them, and maybe send that or make a graphic or something like that, that'd be fascinating. But yeah, we should talk about that more. But take it easy, get some rest. Another heroic effort, as far as I'm concerned, just coming on the show this morning. I really appreciate your time, and I'll be thinking. I'll be working on this, and I'll probably do some more shows, you know, as we come up to next week and talk. Well, certainly more topics on this, but you know, there's nothing wrong with sphere of influence. You don't have to run the world. It's arrogance. You got to get over the arrogance and go over. It's like the arrogance of thinking you can and the ignorance of not knowing that you can't. Those are our two biggest problems.
Well, thank you so much for having me again. And I think that's a great idea about actually mapping out, you know, possible new world orders based on balance of power politics and spheres of influence.
Yep. I'd love to see how you would draw that map, which is big circles over different areas, and see what you come up with. It'd be fascinating. Maybe next week. All right.
Well, sir. I'm afraid my energy level right now isn't equal to the task.
We have to do
but
it
eventually,
next week.
I'll get around. I'll soon get around to it. But I am working on an article. I'm about to complete an article that talks about what we've just discussed. And when it gets published, I'll send it to you.
Well, you can just list countries. You could have like region one, you know, and then region two. Or we start with us as region one. It'd be Canada, Mexico, Alaska, you know, in 1,000 miles in any direction from our shoreline. That'd be one sphere of influence. Another one could be South America. You know, another one, you know, just very, I mean, I'll let you draw the map. It'd be interesting to see. Sub-Saharan Africa might be a region. You know, the Middle East, Northern Africa, and the Middle East and Europe. You know, I don't know. Well, I'll let you draw the map. But yeah, first things first, take it easy. And I'll think about myself. I might try that. I'm going to do a little spheres of influence of my own and send it to you and see what you think. That'd be very interesting.
Well, thank you. Greatly
appreciate. We'll talk about it 1 week. We'll do it when we can. Yeah.
Okay. And despite the gloomy news and everything, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all your listeners.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you, my friend. And thank you for everything you do for the show and all this knowledge that you're sharing. And I'll do my best to share it as far as I can.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You take care now. Bye now.
Happy New Year to you.
There we go. All right. Always an amazing discussion. But, Gene, what do you think? Think I can make a map of a spheres of influence, or we'll get Dr. Pry, we'll sort of divide the world up into these new alliances and see how it goes. We can do one of what it is and what it should be. You know, but so just to get foreign policy, you and I haven't really talked foreign policy. Maybe we can get Pianchi back here, too. But how do you see the United States? You know how I feel. I don't want to be the world's police officer. I don't believe that we have to be the biggest, baddest, greatest. You know, I see the world as arrogance and ignorance. So the arrogance of thinking you have the power, or the arrogance of wanting to exercise the power, and the ignorance of thinking you have it. That's how I see it. How do you see our position in the world now, based on what you heard from Dr. Pry? Oh, I've stumped Gene. Gene's thinking. Unless Gene's not there for some reason. This is one of those days where people are disappearing on me. You know. All right. I've got we only have about 11 minutes left anyway. Maybe we'll get Pianchi back on the line. But this is something that has always fascinated me, especially as someone who lives in other countries. And once you live in other countries, you see countries as they see themselves. And this is the only country I've ever been in that sees itself as like the natural rule of the world, that what's good for Americans is good for everybody, that what we decide here is going to be the best of everything. And there's a lot of really good stuff going on here, but there's Obama made a comment that I agree with. Everybody thought was a horrible thing. He said that, you know, the Greeks are proud of being Greek, and the Egyptians are proud of being Egyptian, and the Chinese are proud of being Chinese, and the Australians are proud of being Australians. Each nation has its own pride. And that's very true. And he knows that because he's lived in other countries. And unless you do that, unless you see how other countries work, you really don't understand how easy it is to become, it's the term ethnocentric, whatever that term is, where you're like an ultra-nationalist, where you're arrogant enough to think the United States can police the world. Are you, you know, in Gene's term, are you kidding me? No, that's not going to happen. There's no way that it had that much power. And what's our vital interest in the Ukraine? We don't have one. Unless Biden has a vital interest in protecting his son's deals. You know, what's our vital interest in Taiwan? We don't have one. What we do have is freedom. And that's where it really comes down to. We have a vested interest in making the as much of the world as possible, as free as possible, because that's the right thing to do. That is our interest. I believe Jimmy Carter is right. We have an interest in human rights and protecting those things. But as far as what we can do with Ukraine or Taiwan, I would give Taiwan a million AR-15s. And Ukraine, I'd say get your nukes back. You know, that's what they need to do. Pianki, welcome back. Did you enjoy our discussion with Dr. Pry?
Yeah, he always brings such a great perspective. And being able to even realize far-fetched events like Midway, for instance, where in the beginning we utilized pilots that were not experienced and well-trained, and right. It was devastating. Yeah, so it goes to show that in order to remain in the number one spot, and not being boasters, but being a beacon for the rest of the world that want to pull themselves out of the despise that they're in, it requires constant maintenance, constant improvement.
But this is the arrogance I was talking about, the arrogance of thinking you have to be in the number one spot. You know, when I grew up and lived in three different countries, you know, each country to me seemed valuable for itself. But, you know, Canadians don't feel the need to make the world Canadian. Australians don't feel the need to make the world Australian. Australians are happy being Australian, happily traveling the world, and happily touring and, you know, sharing Foster's Lager and some other cool things. But they don't – but there's no desire to take over and run other countries. This is the only nation in the world I've seen. And you know, the reason is – well, I mean – other nations will do it to take them over because they want the stuff. You know, most nations take over other nations because they want their people. They want their wealth, all right? But the United States wants to basically direct the rest of the world's affairs because, I don't know. I mean, look at NATO is a perfect example of an organization that was designed to stop Russia from taking over Western Europe. It's lost its way. It's lost its meaning. It costs us billions upon billions upon billions of dollars that we can use here as our inflation rate goes up. With countries to hate it.
Well, it's not.
They don't care about it.
I think you're looking at it. I think you're looking at it from the wrong perspective. Take the New York Yankees, for instance. New York Yankees have probably won twice as many World Series as the next team because of what they put in their farm clubs, what they put in their innovation, and because everybody of talent wants to become part of that organization. It's what they have going for it.
They've got money, too. You know, you're going to make more money playing for the Yankees than probably Kansas City or, you know, some of the other cities out there, especially the newer
cities. Well, yes, people have the freedom and the liberty to exploit their own talent.
Of course. I'm just saying New York, yeah. the Yankees have more money than anybody else. That's why they have drafts.
So
the richest teams don't get all the best players. Yeah.
The same thing with the United States. We should have a lot of emphasis going on and directed towards your innovation, your education, your technology,
right.
your research and development, your manufacturing, uh-huh. going into certain areas like we're looking into space.
We make ourselves better. We don't have to make the rest of the world. You know, I mean, in other words, the freedoms that we have to share, the Declaration of Independence, the rights that we talk about, those can be shared, but they can't be imposed. You can't.
Well,
you
don't have to share them. People can look at them and want to mimic. They do that already. The country of Zambia in Central Africa remodeled its constitution. Well, while it was doing that, it had the U.S. Constitution on the table as a template that it could confer to.
Yep. It's a good place to start. I mean, you adapt it to Zambia, but does Zambia have like a Second Amendment, for example? Did it break up their legislature?
No. They don't have no Second Amendment.
No Second Amendment in Zambia. Do they have, do they let their legislature borrow money, for example?
Yeah, they borrow money. Matter of fact, they went through debt forgiveness about maybe 7 years ago. Now they're back as being a debted country. So that's an irresponsibility.
So one of the worst mistakes governments can make is to put into the Constitution the legislature can borrow money.
Well, you know, another mistake that the government makes is that you don't modernize, you don't innovate that which you have, and that's your people and that's your natural resources. And natural resources should be monetized to pay for the intra-country development rather than going abroad borrowing. And when you don't pay back, well, those your collateral is your natural resources, which you should have used in a proper way in the beginning. And that requires you to
stewardship. Yeah, you got to have stewardship.
Yeah.
You got to have you got to have management and planning. It's like growth. We have in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Here we have unrestricted growth. We have way too many people moving in way too fast. They're trying to build way too many roads, way too many schools, way too many sewer hookups. They're not ready for it.
You have to invest in your own people. That's where the ethnocentricity comes into play. Nobody's going to better care for the country than the people that live in the country itself.
Oh, great. Well, see, it's vital interest. People act in their vital interest. One of the things I wanted to talk about with Peter Pry is the idea of isolationism, because what he's talking about, the first thing that the neocons and the permanent war class, they're gonna label him an isolationist. You're like a Trump American nationalist. You're an isolationist. You don't believe in foreign trade and immigration, and you don't believe in. Of course, none of that's true. He does believe in foreign trade. He does believe in immigration. He does believe in all those things. But what he doesn't believe in is selling our country out and bankrupting our country for some ridiculous ideal of control that we don't have. Again, arrogance and ignorance. Those are the yin and yang of foreign policy. Military policy. So the arrogance of the ignorance of what you don't know you can't do.
You look at Obama and Hillary Clinton, how they would chip down at the cultural traditions and standards of a country bit by bit by bit, right, under the pretense of freedom and liberty.
They don't understand freedom and liberty.
No, they don't. You leave those countries alone to live with their traditions. If they want to change them, let them change them. Don't encourage a small faction within the country to say, look and say that there's something wrong. We want to be like them. We want to be able to have, for instance, same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to have abortion on demand. Leave those countries alone. Why would you encourage that? And then when you do encourage that, when they do start taking on those aspects, they start chipping away at the sovereignty of their country, little by little.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially with the Spanish countries, which are mostly Catholic, you know, and the idea that you can have foreign aid if you have abortion. You can have, you know, military aid if you have, critical race theory. I forgot who I was talking to or where I heard this on the news, but, that's the policy. These military folks, you know, are now and foreign policy in the State Department, they're so into their leftist Marxism, you know, the splitting of everything into their various fragments and segments, that they're totally screwing our country over. You know, and nothing Peter talked about was really interesting is the split between Russia and China. That should be the first thing we do. I've talked about that for a long time. Remember the James Bond film where Russia and China were battling each other? You know, they battle each other. They've been battling each other for thousands of years.
What that methodology is called? It's called soft power. Waving a carrot, soft power. That's what it's called.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to go over the military.
I call it psychological warfare. Yeah, but that's what it really is.
Well,
that's
all included. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all included.
I'm sorry, go ahead. We're both talking. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
It's all included. Psychological warfare, it's all included.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. We've only got about a minute left, so we'll have to do this again tomorrow. Actually, tomorrow we've got a bunch of reporters. You know, Monday's a good day for us to kind of chat and have long discussions, especially when Peter gets us going here. Tuesday, it's a lot quicker. There's a lot more people here, so it gets much busier. But the arrogance, again, look at foreign policy in terms of arrogance and ignorance, and what are – you know, and I just made that up today. I hadn't really thought about it, but what our sphere of influence seems to me, I mean, in the 30 seconds we have left, does that make sense to you that if we can protect us, Alaska, you know, and our sphere of influence is Canada, Mexico, and the Atlantic and the Pacific. If we can guard our shorelines, you know, keep people from invading from the north and the south and protect Alaska, that's pretty much our vital interest. Anything other than that, we should make alliances and help. But we shouldn't be controlling or paying for anything outside of our Mexico, Canada, Northern Hemisphere, North America sphere of influence. Yes or no? You agree? And if not, we'll pick up tomorrow.
Well, I think that it should be much broader than what it is into the Atlantic, because you see those that's coming from the eastern end of Asia coming around to the west coast, for instance, of Africa, spreading into the Atlantic Ocean sphere. So it should be the greatest.
Right.
It should be what you mentioned, but maybe just a little bit more.
Okay, I can
like
go to the Caribbean.
Russia would be wanting to put
Caribbean
missiles in Venezuela.
Up to the Windward Islands, yeah. But, you know, we got to go. We'll have to talk about tomorrow. Thanks, Bianchi. Appreciate it. Gene, thank you, too. Dr. Pry, you know, always thanks to him. And tomorrow, it's our Crazy Busy Tuesday, starting with Gene. Gene's going to kick it off with Are You Kidding Me?, her Tuesday morning report. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction and our new improved website, writeyourlaws.com. And again, press release going out, 25 bills to rock 2022. It's our guidelines and recommendations for the legislation candidates should be running on for the 2022 midterms. And I'll be back tomorrow.